Light comes on. We're good. Okay, we're good. Yep.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the House Special Committee on Small Business Growth. Today is August 22nd. The agenda wasn't posted on August 15th. We have a busy schedule today. We're going to put on the front end of the schedule Mark Gregory, our SBDC network director, who's going to come up and talk to us about funding support for small business development centers. So, Mark, anyone you want to come up and join you, you bring your team. Welcome.
Thank you. Let's see if we're on here.
You know the routine. We just need to introduce yourself for the record.
Sure. So, co-chairs Gomberg, co-chair Smith, and members of the committee, I'm Mark Gregory, state director of the Oregon Small Business Development Center Network. Provided opening testimony to the House Small Business Growth Committee this spring and outlined statewide small business assistance services by our SBDC network through our 19 centers hosted across the 17 community colleges and two regional universities here in Oregon. Small business is a key driver of the local, regional, and state economies. Our network supports small business by offering training, mentorship, market research, and helping access capital. Our center supports small business by matching the resources of the statewide network with the support in the local communities. These efforts to help to create greater diversity by bringing people with different backgrounds, understandings, and perspectives into the business community, which helps enhance all of our communities. I'm joined today by two of my colleagues, Mr. Noah Brockman. He's a statewide capital access team leader for the Small Business Development Center Network, and Dave Price, who is the Oregon Coast Community College SBDC director. Both will provide a unique perspective regarding Oregon small business needs. I'd also like to submit for the committee's consideration a supplemental $1.5 million funding request for the 2017-19 biennium to help support key SBDC services, which align with Governor's economic priorities. This proposal allows our centers to serve an additional 2,000 small business clients over the biennium and create an additional 500 new jobs that we validate with the client and they attribute to our services. The proposal includes a $1.1 million over the next biennium for core funding to our centers statewide. This calculates to approximately $30,000 per center per year, $60,000 over the biennium. Dave will talk about the small business needs of rural businesses, our close partnerships on the coast, and more specifically about the successful history of our signature small business management program that's been around as long as the network, a little over 33 years. The second part of the proposal is for $400,000 to sustain the successful five-year history of our network's economic gardening efforts, newly branded as Scale Oregon. This assistance is focused on traded sector companies that are uniquely poised for high job growth in the state. Noah Brockman is going to share some unique perspectives regarding how our capital access team supports statewide assistance to those high growth companies. With that, I'd like to pass the mic to Noah Brockman.
Welcome. Thank you, Co-Chair Smith, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. I'm Noah Brockman, Capital Access Team Lead for the Oregon SBDC Network. Thank you for this opportunity to provide testimony about the CAT team and share a little bit more about our program. The CAT team got its start in 2011 as a statewide Oregon SBDC Network specialized service through federal grant funding through the 2010 Small Business Jobs Act. That funding allowed Capital Access team to provide business advising to the entire Oregon SBDC network, 19 SBDCs around the state. Typically, Capital Access team advising means working with small business clients on business planning, financial projections, finance strategy development, loan packaging, and relationships with different funders around the state. These activities are pretty typical preparation required for a small business to obtain debt and equity financing, everything from the $50,000 line of credit to the multi-million dollar project. Over the past 5 years, the CAT team has grown statewide. We have four regional teams taking clients through a rigorous five-step process. For the last 3 years, we've actually hosted monthly professional development conference calls for our colleagues in our SBDC network, especially those financial business advisors, in order for them to stay current on sources of capital around the state. Through the year, we also provide public workshops, trainings on capital access and financing literacy around the state. And since 2011, the Oregon SBDC CAT team has really been the only Oregon business technical service provider 100% dedicated to working with small business on advising and training for traditional and non-traditional capital access. We don't do it alone. It takes a village to raise a fund. So we do this by engaging our referral partners back and forth with small business clients, providing that advising and training. Our typical referral partners include the SBDCs in our network, banks and credit unions, non-traditional lenders, councils of governments, Oregon's angel groups, our partners at the SBA Oregon District Office and Office of International Trade, USDA, of course, Business Oregon's finance team and the business development officers there, as well as Secretary of State Small Business Advocate Ruth Miles, Hatch, Oregon, as well as Oregon cities, counties, and economic development districts. Admittedly, our five-step process is rigorous, as I mentioned. Only 35% of the businesses that we take them through complete that program. However, of those that do finish, 75% of them, based on our data, do receive funding. The past 5 years, the program has provided 6,300 hours of one-on-one business advising specifically on capital access to over 630 small businesses. And of those, we assisted about 174 projects were funded. The average funding amount was $429,000. Total funding acquired over the past 5 years, $78 million in capital. And just to give you an idea of the economic impact, so that's about 185 new jobs, 24 new business starts, and a program return on investment of 132x. So for every dollar invested in the program, we generated $132 out. And just to put this into context, last year was a pretty busy year. CAT team statewide facilitated $31.8 million. It was a big year for capital, and that was half of the overall Oregon SBDC network's $62 million in capital formation. So that concludes my prepared remarks. I'm going to pass it back to Mark Gregory, our state director.
Yes, and Dave Price is going to talk a little bit more, both as a rural center in Oregon, as well as some unique things that have happened on the coast as they originated our small business management program the very first some 33 years ago.
Welcome. It has been some time. Well, Co-Chairs Gomberg and Co-Chair Smith, I thank you for this opportunity to address you this afternoon. As you've heard, I do come before you today as one of the directors of as the director of one of the smallest SBDCs in the state. We're based at, depending on how you measure it, either the smallest or the second smallest community college in the state as well. But size really doesn't form the root of the concerns that that we have when we deal with our rural economy, as many of the rural centers across the state do. There's some pretty stark statistics that form a backdrop of our service platform. One of them is Lincoln County's median family income today stands at around $42,000, just shy of it, actually. That's 16% below the state average. Further, 11% of Lincoln County families today live in poverty, below the poverty line as defined by the federal limit. And as you might imagine, in that community and also a county that is in large part, it varies quite a bit regionally, and we can get into that if you'd like. But the vast majority of businesses in Lincoln County are micro enterprises, and that is five or fewer employees, and they have challenges that are unique to businesses and firms of that size, where everyone has to wear many hats. And again, as a director of a small center, I can appreciate that. Despite all those challenges, though, Lincoln County positively overflows with entrepreneurs who are willing to take great risks. We see them every day to pursue their dreams. And thanks to the support provided by the state of Oregon, the Oregon Small Business Development Center Network, the Small Business Administration, our generous host, Oregon Coast Community College, and also because of close partnerships that we've formed over the years with our county and the cities that we serve, who also contribute financially to our cause. We can proudly say that our small center punches above its weight when it comes to client service and what we can provide to entrepreneurs and would-be entrepreneurs. Our center exists to build joy and wealth in Lincoln County, and we do that by helping start, grow, and retain profitable businesses there. Last year alone, just a few quick stats, we served more than 180 businesses and pre-venture clients with well over 1,000 hours of confidential one-on-one business advising. On top of that, we held north of 75 different workshops and classes, the businesses that we serve secured just shy of $1 million in capital formation last year alone, which for Lincoln County is a big drop. We accomplished all this in partnership, not alone, but in partnership with many local agencies. For example, we work closely with the Employment Department. In fact, two of the key personnel in the Newport office of the Oregon Employment Department serve on my advisory committee today. We have long partnered with the Lincoln County Economic Development Alliance to lever up our size and deliver an unexpected level of service to small businesses throughout our county and our service area. Just a recent example of this is earlier this year, we launched the Oregon Coast SBD Digital Media and Marketing Studio. It is a still photography, video, audio, and graphic design studio located within our office that local businesses can now use with help or without, on their own or with our staff, to produce world-class marketing materials to help sell Lincoln County-made products across the state and the region and even the globe. And that project was funded in large part by a grant that was overseen and made available by the Economic Development Alliance. The SBDC was also instrumental in facilitating the placement of the Northwest Workforce Investment Board inside our campus of Oregon Coast Community College, directly across the hall. And we look forward to working with the WIB to forge new workforce solutions for Lincoln County, and they've been a great partner thus far in this young relationship. So all of these partners support our core mission to serve local entrepreneurs. You probably know this, but we provide free, confidential, one-on-one business advising to anyone, along with powerful real-world workshops with takeaways that businesses can really learn today and use tomorrow. This fall, two of these workshops will actually feature Jennifer Jamunson from Boley. If ever there were a time for an employment law workshop, now might be it. And she's coming on September 28th to two of our locations. We are also following that up with a workshop on the coast with GCAP, the Government Contract Assistance Program, to help local businesses take advantage of all the contracting. You might have seen there's some contracting happening on Highway 20 lately. And projects like that abound with opportunities, even for the smallest clients that we serve, if they're properly certified, and we can help them get there. Other classes coming this fall alone will include online cloud-based accounting services, business law, social media marketing, and, of course, many other topics. We select those topics based on local needs. Just at the end of last year and through this spring, we conducted what we believe to be by far the largest business education needs assessment survey that's ever been conducted in our county. It included, among other things, a mailing to every address in the county. And it has really defined what our fall, winter, and spring terms will offer. Further, thanks to close relationships with local lenders and with organizations like NOAA's Capital Access Team, we are able to provide local business owners with the expertise and assistance they need to grow and thrive, even if that's not available in our center. So finally, as Mark suggested, each year the Oregon Coast SBDC presents the Small Business Management Program we have for more than 20 years. It's an intensive course that runs the entire academic year, and it couples powerful monthly instruction sessions with regular one-on-one business counseling to provide impactful support to businesses wherever they are in terms of stages on the life cycle. And it helps them identify and overcome the challenges that they find most pressing working with their counselor, and also to achieve the goals that they set out at the start of the program. We spend a lot of time at the beginning finding out exactly what they want to get out of this and making sure, of course, they know what they're getting into as well. Our SBM has a thriving alumni group, as you might imagine. Hundreds of Lincoln County businesses have been through the program over the years. Just one example I want to throw at you, RQ Mills Ace Hardware. a well-respected business in Lincoln County, is one that enjoyed their experience with the SBM and is happy to share that. And as one bit of evidence, at the end of last year, they made their second major contribution to our SBDC's foundation account. It was just shy of $15,000, and it is dedicated to helping other small businesses who might not be able to otherwise afford to participate in that program. And we're deeply moved by that show of support from folks who've been through it. And I can tell you, speaking of, as a former small business owner on the Oregon coast and a past participant throughout an SBM program at Oregon Coast, I can personally vouch for the profound power of that program and the resources and expertise that it can bring to bear for even those of us who own businesses way out there on the edge of the earth. And with that, I thank you for your time and look forward to fielding your questions.
Perfect.
Well, thanks. And Co-Chairs Gomberg and Co-Chair Smith and members of the committee, I pledged during my opening testimony of the first hearing of this House Small Business Growth Committee this spring to provide updates regarding small business needs. Just want to provide a brief update as well as let you understand some specific actions that we could take in the future to address them. I'll include to the co-chairs a copy that we just received from Business Oregon, who collaborated with us at your suggestion on a Oregon small business growth scan. It happens to time very closely with the capital scan that's put forward by University of Oregon, and it does have some revealing numbers, both in terms of some of the small business needs, regulatory issues, barriers, and so I expect that we should be able to have that to the co-chairs and the committee for a future meeting that I can respond to at that time. I also want to recognize the Oregon Manufacturing Extension Partnership and the Government Contract Assistance Program. We all surveyed our 2015 clients, and the survey responses represent a cross-section of clients served of about 540 businesses statewide, of which 418 were SBDC. Were served by the SBDC in 2015. So, again, I'd hope that I might be able to come back and talk more about some of those specific needs and perhaps actions. It definitely allowed our clients to rate the importance of business assistance needs, respond to questions that were asked in an open way, and provides specific actions that could be taken. My request for the $1.5 million supplemental funding is additional to the Oregon Small Business Development Center Network's 2017-19 base appropriation of what's $2.66 million that was just passed through the Business Oregon Commission. It accompanies client-validated performance results and client survey needs that really speak for themselves. I assert to you that the OSBDCN maintains higher standards of accountability, validity, and transparency than any other program within Business Oregon's management portfolio. You heard today from my colleagues about both the rural and statewide business assistance needs and the importance of SBDC services. Thank you for your full consideration of our request. On behalf of the OSBDCN, I look forward to providing you and your colleagues with an exceptional return on investment during the remainder of this biennium and the years ahead.
Thank you. Colleagues, questions? Representative.
Thank you. And I'm not sure who can answer this, but as I listen to you talk about capital formation, and I've read the figures about how many total people, businesses, potential businesses that you serve, and I'm not really talking about those that may just come and take a class, but I'm trying to understand, so how many of them, what's the figure on the number that you deal with from a capital formation versus those that can come in and go through even the training in that, then they're fine and they don't need that help. So what is that? Because we know there's a lot out there that you never get to see and talk about, but I'm just trying to understand that figure.
And Noah could probably answer on the capital access team side, and then I'll answer a little bit on the network as a whole.
Thank you.
Because in some cases, there's smaller requests.
Sure. So just so as I mentioned, Representative Lively, over the past 5 years, if you look at that span, it's been, I think, we've talked to 630 small businesses.
So what, excuse me, so what does it mean when you say you talk to them? I mean, did they come in looking for capital? Is that what they came in for? Were they somewhere else in the? So when they get to you, they're looking for capital.
Representative Lively, yes. So they'll be referred to us with an inquiry and ask for assistance with capital access. And you know, as I said, probably about 35% of those will complete our process.
Yeah.
The rest, for a number of reasons may not.
Sure.
Sure.
Representative Lively, on top of the clients that we might refer up the chain to CAT team where we don't have the local expertise, I wish I had a number. I can tell you that $949,000 was raised in the last fiscal year from clients who directly attributed that in impact statements to assistance that they, whether that's working through a business plan and getting prepared to go see a lender. But I wish I had the percentage. It's a high percentage of the clients that walk in our door, mm-hmm. whether they're pre-venture or existing businesses. Capital is on their minds.
Yeah.
And so we talk about a lot of solutions. And whether we're preparing them to sharpen a business plan so they can go to a wonderful rich uncle we all wish we had, or to other sources, or to Amy Pearl and Community Capital, or wherever they might be headed. The first step to that is to know where they're going with a plan. And I'd love to be able to give you a percentage, but I can tell you it's many clients that we see that capital is first and foremost. And we don't capture all those dollars because we don't know where they wind up successfully achieving, where they turn for that money once they have an idea to sell in a business.
Great. Thank you.
And I could go further just to say on behalf of the statewide network. So, you know, Noah's team works in some of the larger deals and has staged, again, you know, a little over $30 million. But as you can see in some of the handout, the blue attachment of our impacts, we've got about $62 million. It was really a high water mark in the previous calendar year. The typical average size, and this will give you the number of clients, is somewhere in the neighborhood of around $60,000. So you're talking around that 1,000 client mark of in between 5,500 to 6,000 clients that we serve annually. Mm-hmm. So that gives us a ballpark. But many clients come with the M word, the money on their mind, but we end up being able to serve them a lot of other ways in that process.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I had a question as it relates to the cost for a business to participate in your programs. Can you give us kind of an idea of what that looks like?
Sure, and it's a question relevant also to the proposal, so it's a great question. So in the case of the Small Business Administration and the federal funds that are provided to us, we're about 1% of the nation's funds through SBA. So the SBA requires that we not charge clients for any of our counseling as a part of our federal requirements. Now, at the same time, we are able to charge for training. And so, for example, in our proposal, one of the key areas that I'm excited about in being able to expand the small business management program, which can come at a fee, in the rural areas, usually around $500 or so, and some of that's even scholarship, as Dave mentioned earlier. And it can, in the Portland area, just because of the nature of the speakers, and we even have people that fly in to participate, can be upwards of $1,500. But the answer is that we'll raise about $850,000 to $1 million a year from programs like the Small Business Management Program, which is our primary income source and training program, but we raised zero in the case of counseling because it is free to all clients.
So can I have a follow-up?
Yeah,
thank you. So when you look at the 10-month class period time they sign up and you do the counseling and the classroom work, is there no fee for that? Or do they pay a fee?
So here's how it elastically allows us to continue our growth, and that's the point I'm most excited about, is from a standpoint that they've paid for training, it gives us capacity at the center like Dave's to then deliver additional counseling over what he might have been able to previously. So those clients will often engage upwards of 20 hours in one-on-one advising, where that might have been very difficult otherwise to provide a client. So it is free to them on the counseling side, but the funds, you know, clearly provide a needed revenue source. And frankly, a leverage to a proposal like this, it stages right at about a one-to-one match of what we are requesting at the $1.5 million.
And I can tell you, Representative Hack, that thank you for the question. When I took part in this program in 2008, I wrote a check for $500. Today, we are almost 10 years later, and a local business in Lincoln County is going to pay $600 for the program.
That's what I wanted.
For a 10-month program. Tonight, I'm going before the Lincoln City Urban Renewal Agency in another effort to secure some additional funds so that we can make with part with scholarships that allow the client to have some skin in the game, but also lower that burden a bit because of those micro enterprises and the folks we're working to serve in Lincoln County to lessen that burden. But that's where we're looking at the $600
The average?
It's around there for rural centers. I think, as Mark said, 500 to 600 is probably right on, and then it gets steeper in the larger centers when the speaker cost increases and such.
So if I heard you correctly, the free confidential one-on-one advising is free to the client, but the trainings, whether it's the small business management or other trainings, might have a fee associated with it depending upon what the class is being offered.
They might indeed. I can tell you that we always offer free workshops each term in addition to the counseling, whether that is a doing business in Lincoln County class or what have you. But a typical three-hour session is going to cost you $35 at the Lincoln County SBDC, the Oregon Coast SBDC. That varies a bit also by property. But then, again, the small business management program is a different kettle of fish with the 10 months, et cetera.
Any other questions, Representative?
Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And committee, you all know I'm a fan. I'm a fan, and I'm so pleased to have the SBDC back in front of us again. And I'm particularly pleased to have one of my directors, Mr. Price, here. This is a guy that takes ideas and turns them into businesses and turns those businesses into sustainable futures for the owners and jobs for their employees. It's a huge success story, and as good as he is, I suspect that he's not unusual amongst the other 19 networks. That being said, Mr. Gregor.
Mr. Co-Chair, he's the best.
Well, I hear the guy in Hermiston isn't so bad.
Yeah, he's a little flaky. This guy's the best.
Well, then we're fortunate, but I suspect there's a lot of stars out there. Mr. Gregory, what I heard is that you're looking for a supplemental ask next year. You're hoping for a supplemental ask of $1.5 million. That's $30,000 per center, and you're saying that with that $30,000, we can help 2,000 businesses. We can create another 50 jobs. 25 jobs per center. I'm trying to imagine, Mr. Co-Chair, if a company came to Oregon and said, we're going to create 500 jobs, what the headline would be in our statewide newspaper. And instead, what we've got is an organization that's creating 500 jobs across the entire state, in every corner of our state, through our 19 different programs that are part of the network. And that's a remarkable success story. I'm trying to get the larger context here, Mr. Gregory. There is a question in my line of thinking here. The larger context is you're getting currently 2.66 from the state. What's the total budget? I mean, what kind of skin do other people have in this game? Because I don't want to leave anybody with the impression that all of the money is coming from the state. You're just asking for part of your funding from us.
That's correct. And so in terms of the funding, and I'll give a quick history through the recession in my 8 years here in Oregon. You know, obviously, everybody through the recession suffered greatly, public services included, and our funds actually went down to only about $500,000 a year of state funding against what was then about $1.2 million of federal. The federal has been slow to grow as well. In the core funds, we're now at $1.3 million, or very close to a one-to-one match of that 2.6 on the biennium. So we're fairly even matched, but I say that on core funds in that, for example, and we're just about to release this as news, so you're the first to hear, our network competed in an SBA portable assistance grant process through the SBA that other SBDC networks compete for. And we had about a 3-to-1 odds on in terms of the number of applicants, and we've received $100,000 and got notice that just this last week. That'll actually be spread between 10 centers. We take no administrative costs on those funds to deliver on specific regional needs in distressed communities throughout rural Oregon. They have to actually prove that they're economically distressed from layoff and unemployment. Other federal dollars that we've been able to leverage above the state's one-to-one match at core have included, actually, we also got notice this week of $100,000 of SBA supplemental funds. And this is something where we're addressing priorities for international trade, cybersecurity, which is another
federal one, as well as we actually are working with the Department of Corrections in a really neat program to work with the prisoners, which we've always done, but it's going to enable them to actually provide business work from the prisons, and the profits go to repay some of the from some of the victims. So we're doing some very unique programs in those distressed communities. But in total, just important to remember that the 2.66 is on core funds, about evenly matched with the state. And again, to Representative Hack's earlier question, I believe that our program income is a sufficient one-to-one match for the $1.5 million that we're requesting.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Representative. Mr. Co-Chair, I would just like to respond. I think you raised an interesting point. We've had these conversations before, the value of a job and the fact that the headline about 500 jobs, but yet they could do it. And somehow we have to get to the point where we understand the value of the job is more in those rural communities. Again, and I've heard different figures about one job there is worth 10 in Portland or something, whatever that is. But in our thinking, in order to talk about the value of the money that we invest and what we get back, we've got to do a better job of making sure we articulate what the real value of those jobs being created is versus what's happening in the large metropolitan areas. But I think that's a key point.
Well, and if I could, Mr. Co-Chair, by way of conversation here, the coming fiscal environment is a little bit unclear. We'll know better in November what we're going to be all looking at in January and February, but we're going to have a number of asks in front of us. These folks are going to come in and they'd like to see an extra 1.5. It's my sense that if we look at some of the other programs we're funding, we're getting an enormous bang for the buck out of our SBDCs. And I hope, Mr. Co-Chair, that we're going to be looking very hard at this additional ask. I recognize that it's an additional ask, but 500 more jobs, $1.5 million spread across the entire state, this is going to be a very good conversation to have.
Yeah, Mr. Co-Chair, it's interesting. As you folks know, I serve down in Ways and Means, and we deal with budgetary issues all the time. We're always looking at leverage. We're looking at opportunity cost. And I think your observation is dead on. We spend millions and millions of dollars to create incentives to bring business to Oregon. All the while, we have an opportunity to create our own at a nominal cost with a very, very strong upside. And so I think your observation is correct. Let me ask a few questions. Governor Brown and Speaker Kotek are very, very sensitive to making sure that we provide opportunities for all Oregonians, and that includes our Latino community. In District 57, my population is 60%+ Latino, and I see that with additional funding, we might be able to provide additional assistance to that Latino community. Can you just elaborate a little bit more on what that might mean for the state of Oregon if those dollars were to be available?
Yes, Co-Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Smith, and members of the committee, we've had some amazing success in partnership with a number of foundations and community organizations in serving the Latina small business populations. One strategic partnership includes the Ford Family Foundation, who provided a $200,000 grant this year and sees us as a strategic partner in future years to serve those communities. That was one part of that proposal. In addition, we have worked with rural development initiatives through a program called Pasos El Éxito. We're also working actually with the State Department and an effort through America's SBDC on a sister-center relationship in Mexico, and exploring that as an opportunity to both bring trade as well as translated resources into the state, and us sharing best practices with them and foreign centers. So there's some really unique things that we're doing specific to those communities. Our rural centers have nearly all partnered with the Pasos El Éxito program, which really begins at a financial literacy piece. And then the Ford family is actually, their foundational funds are kind of in that next stage of business. Once those businesses have been formed, they have that basic understanding of business to take them to the next level, kind of like a preemptive small business management program for those clients in Spanish. So we've got some great work going on. We have 16 Spanish-speaking business advisors around the state, and very proud of the program.
And I would just share with you, in District 57, that's something we're sensitive to. We want to continue to encourage opportunity for all folks, so we appreciate that. I want to raise one other issue, and I want to preface it by saying I really, really appreciate the network working so closely with Business Oregon. There's strong collaboration, there's strong partnerships, there's great communication. That hasn't always been the case, and so kudos for what you're doing there. I want to encourage the network and Business Oregon out in TV land, wherever they all may be, to continue with that collaboration and to remember the sensitivity as we're building partnerships about that confidential nature of business advising. Because I do know there's a lot of pressures to create collaborations that might compromise that. And as a person who works with a lot of business owners who knows exactly what you're having to deal with, I think the legislature's sensitive to making sure we always protect confidentiality. And so whatever that means as you're having future discussions on future programs, I hope you folks would keep that in mind. And I hope those out in Business Oregon land would remember how valuable it is to maintain that confidentiality. So appreciate you folks coming.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Have a great day.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Appreciate you. Okay. Dr. Knoxel, welcome. And we know you folks have other commitments, so don't feel free to scoot. Okay, Dr. Knoxel, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So we have 30 minutes on the agenda.
I'm ready.
The time is yours.
So good afternoon. My name is Sherry Knoxel, and I serve as the director of the Austin Family Business Program at Oregon State University's College of Business. So Co-Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Smith, thank you for the invitation to be here today. So I'd first like to say that your work to help all small businesses grow is going to help family businesses grow. And many of the speakers who have already addressed the special committee, they own and operate family businesses, and their comments reflect a snapshot of their current business issues. So I've organized my comments today around four major themes that connect growth to the unique issues of family-owned businesses in the state. The Austin Family Business Program was started at OSU over 30 years ago as a way to contribute to Oregon's economy at the time in the mid-1980s. So it is now the oldest university-based program in the U.S. addressing the needs of family business owners. There are roughly 100 programs for family businesses around North America, and there are roughly 60 family business education programs based at U.S. universities. So AFBP is an education program, and we have a mission of education and of access. We structure our educational programs as a safe space and a confidential forum for families to convene, to learn from each other, to learn from faculty, and also from professional advisors and consultants on specific issues and topics that are of concern. So AFBP, it's not a membership organization. We have a statewide mission. We do not provide subsidizing consulting engagements for individual families, but we do provide an online class and a campus, traditional campus class for our enrolled students. So in a typical year, we're able to reach about 1,000 families through our events, our workshops, our student scholarships, our campus classes, and many of the industry meetings that we're invited to where we're hosting workshops and hosting talks. So while OSU, or AFBP, we receive administrative support and housing from Oregon State University. Our programs and our three staff are funded primarily from endowment income, from program registrations, from grants, and from donations. So given that we're a small staff with a large scope, we rely on our contacts with industry representatives, chambers of commerce, economic development agencies, university colleagues, and SBDC contacts as well to reach our families. So in preparing this presentation, we do have in family business, as we study family business, we really have what I call the data challenge. And that is because metrics for family-owned businesses are hard to find, and they're hard to find for two reasons. One, definitionally, what is a family business? If you look to the research literature, some scholars have cited more than 19 different definitions of family business. So for our program, we generally consider a family business if the family has predominantly the strategic control control of the direction of the business, and if there's an intent to pass the business to the next generation. The second reason that data are hard to find is because these are private businesses. So the financial data are not always available to the research faculty and the scholars. So the data that we do use, they're collected from surveys and from case studies and from industry reports that we have to evaluate very, very closely. But you will find that family businesses are in all sizes. They're in all sectors, including things like healthcare and technology, where you might not expect to find family businesses. And one point I really want to make from a lot of studies over the years, contrary to perhaps some of the media reports, family ownership is not an inherent disadvantage in competitiveness. Family ownership can, in fact, be an advantage as long as the family has the commitment and the discipline to structure their business and to have sound business practices. Now, when we look at, I've listed some statistics for you, family enterprise at a glance. So in Oregon, it's generally believed and agreed that between 80 and 90% of our businesses are family owned. Specifically in the agricultural industry, we're able to get better statistics as we drill down. Approximately 92% of agricultural enterprises are family owned. As I looked back in the history, I've been in the position for 5 years now as director, and as I've been studying family businesses and measurement in Oregon, I found two very specific studies that were done. One was in 1989, looking at small businesses with less than 50 employees. And in 1989, they found that 76% of those small businesses were family-owned. By 1993, a similar, very rigorous study was done with less than 50 employees. 84% were family-owned. So that's why I feel very comfortable with that range of 80 to 90%. From some of the surveys that have been done in the Northwest, we can see that roughly 80% of the 88% of the Northwest families expect their business to continue to the next generation in the next 5 years, but 48%, as you can see, have done some of the planning. Beyond a will, they've actually documented some estate plans. So that's the gap that we really pay attention to and we work on. And the final bullet is the most important piece, I feel, in the presentation today, and that is, as you look at family businesses, the way that we're measuring success in family business currently is the contemporary family business experience. It's not about survival of that original business unit that the founder created into a next generation and a next generation. It's really about the success of the family enterprise. That particular founder created an asset, created wealth, created value in the community, employed residents of the community. And if the, as they move forward, many family businesses will sell that business, give the next generation the opportunity to move into a different business. So we see that successful family businesses own, on average, 3.4 businesses. By the third generation, they've owned roughly 6 businesses. So they're very enterprising. So I was asked to speak on the very unique issues, trying to separate small businesses from family business issues and thinking about the experience of the CEO who's running a family enterprise versus someone who's running a public corporation or a sole proprietorship. So there are 5 different points that we could look at, and one clearly is that as you're operating a family business, as a CEO, you're spending much more time communicating about the business, educating the family, keeping them aware, particularly if you have minority shareholders who are in the business. Also, as a CEO, you're going to think about longer planning horizons, longer timelines in terms of planning the success of your business. I've worked with a family business in Lowell, Oregon, who are thinking with a 100-year planning horizon. That's 3 generations out from their current operation. So it's very, very interesting and different and unique way to plan your business going forward. The generational transfers, where the incoming generation buys the business from the incumbent generation, that can be a very financially stressful time for these family businesses because capital is needed to pay out the parents, and then typically at that time of transition, capital is also needed for reinvestment in the business to upgrade in technology, upgrade in equipment, upgrade in personnel, and prepare that business, kind of refresh that business for the next generation. CEOs of family businesses have to have the succession of their leadership as a key responsibility if they are a steward of the family business assets. So this requires objective evaluation of their own children, perhaps even harder, their siblings' children, or other relatives, cousins in the family. They're trying to select and cultivate the leadership qualities that are going to help those family members succeed in business, or make the determination that we do not have family members who have the aptitude or the interest to run this business. And while we can stay family-owned, we're going to need to find a non-family leader. And then finally, as I meet with many of the attorneys, financial planners, investment advisors, retirement planners, they will tell you that their family business clients and the way they engage a family business client is very different. Those engagements are not transaction-based, and they're really about learning the families, the individual families' values, their goals, their history. They're working within a more complex system because you have family ownership to execute the business, to execute the succession agreements. Those are the business issues, but there are also unique family issues. And I think Co-Chair Comberg, I know he's made the remark that you can't really legislate that family get along, so I appreciate the comment. And I bring these issues up because I want to increase your appreciation and understanding of the pressures of the responsibilities that family CEOs have and their continued commitment and their passion to being successful. So they are also looking at these family issues as well, recognizing that every family business is unique in their structure and their history and their family. I've just chosen two relatively large categories or buckets of family issues that we could look at. And one very important aspect, and one where we spend a lot of time in our workshops, is the fact that families can get into trouble if there is not a separation between the family issues, their family roles, and the business roles. One of the second-generation family owners of a roofing company, Eugene, has told me that it's hard to tell where the family ends and the business begins. It's like one big root ball. So we're trying to help the families untangle the root ball, because if you don't separate your personal goals from your business goals, these are three potential disadvantages, if you will, that can happen in the business. One is that you're not able to select the successor. You're not dealing with the individuality of your children, and you leave all of the business assets to the eldest child. Perhaps they're most qualified, perhaps not. Or we also see where families will leave all of the assets evenly divided amongst the children, even though there is one child who's more engaged and more interested in managing the business going forward. So they've now put all the siblings in a business partnership. So the differentiation of roles and how you can be responsible to your family and how you can be responsible to your business is very important. Also, it can lead to the lack of departure of the CEO in terms of leaving and exiting the business when it's most appropriate. If they haven't worked to develop their personal goals, their personal vision, separate from their role as a CEO, then sometimes we find that they stay too long in that CEO role, and they're not giving room for the next generation to come in. Also, another aspect, if there's not good separation, healthy separation between the business and the family, and that is resentment. Many of the children growing up feel there was too much attention, too much time spent in the business, and that resentment can play out down the road. So that's one large bucket of family business issues. The other bucket is, in general, the fact that families have to work on harmony, on the family glue, on family unity, to try to avoid conflict. What we see in families can be, particularly if there's an untimely death or a divorce, that usually results in a remarriage, and now you have a blended family. What does that mean for the assets of the family going forward? Is the family really addressing these step relationships? Another aspect is spouses and bringing in married partners into the family business system. When I'm working with students, I teach a senior seminar for students who are from Family Business on campus. I share with my students that the most important career decision they will make is who they marry. And I'm trying to make them very aware of the responsibilities that they have, because this business is playing a very, very large role in their partnership going forward. And so we talk about the impact of spouses on the family business. And so largely another unique family issue is that the CEOs have to pay attention to family unity, helping the young people understand the legacy, how the business was started, the impact of the business, to really create and support the stewardship of the legacy of the business. So as I was reflecting on all of these unique issues and then reflecting on your interest in growth in business, the one thing I came away with is that even with these challenges, family businesses will thrive. And I feel that your work will really reinforce not only this current generation, but also future generations, because these are very entrepreneurial families. The children are right there at the table, and they are watching. They've seen how past generations have met these obstacles and these barriers and overcome these barriers. And the young children are watching and learning, and so the impact of growth today will impact generations going forward. Also, a bit of urgency to the problem is that in the 2015 survey of about 200 family businesses in Oregon and Washington, we're seeing that about 33%, a third of those family business surveyed, are looking at a leadership change in the next 5 years. So we have a tremendous opportunity here ahead of us with this work that we're doing. So putting this all together, I have four themes that connect growth to family business that I want to talk about in my remaining time. And one is that I want us to realize that startups occur in family business. I feel that, number two, exit planning grows businesses. I feel that new generations of family owners grow businesses. And then also the business asset transfer grow businesses. So if we look at the first theme, that startups occur in family businesses, I mean, startups have been occurring in family businesses for generations. And family businesses go through the cycle, the growth, startup growth, maturity, decline. They're going through these cycles again and again. It used to be every generation was a new startup. But with the speed of business today, we're seeing that these startups are happening even within a single generation in the family business. So in the family business research literature, you're seeing the word intrapreneurship, which is being used to describe this concept of starting new ventures within the family business. So clearly, innovation is essential to business success. It's also essential to family business success. And I see one of the differences as I study the innovation and startup culture is that in family businesses, innovation doesn't typically have the end goal of acquisition or of IPO. It really is to sustain the family enterprise. I have pulled some comments from some of the family businesses who've participated in our breakfast workshop last year. With each workshop, we ask our family business CEOs to tell us, you know, what is on your mind for the next 12 to 24 months. And you can see that some of their comments relating to this theme are dealing with growth, they're dealing with competitiveness, and they're dealing with innovation. These are top of mind concerns for our family business owners. So I was thinking that exit planning grows businesses, and it may seem like a paradox, but I think in family business, this paradox is true, in that the senior generation has to exit to make room for the next generation of young entrepreneurs. And so businesses will grow, right, as the generation starts now to engage their children, to develop the interests and the abilities. If the owners wait too long to begin to plan their exit, they tend to lose even their most talented and entrepreneurial children. So this is a very, very important issue. We can see this in agriculture, where we have some of the data. The average age of our farm owners now is 59 years old. It's higher than it's ever been. For every farm owner under 45, there are three who are 65 or older. I've met with Dave Looper and OMEP. They have certified some of their team members in business exit planning to begin to address this issue among Oregon's aging manufacturing owners. Earlier this summer, I had a conversation with two faculty members out of the OSU Sociology Department. They are studying aging ownership in the fishing industry because they're worried about the impact on the coastal communities. So I'm looking forward, they're in the process right now of their data collection this summer. So we're going to visit again in the fall and see how we can address their findings and their issues. So I have to also call out thanks to John Saras and to Gabe Silva, because on the survey that was that Mark mentioned earlier with SBDC clients, we've also included and added exit planning. So I hope we'll get a sense of the interest in exit planning among the SBDC clients going forward. So in terms of the comments that are coming from the CEO owners relative to exit planning, some of them clearly with the first person saying, who will take over, what's the direction? There's been absolutely no planning at this point. So they're, to me, as I read into that statement, they're starting from scratch. The second item, buyout of dad by the second generation. This reflects, as I mentioned, that importance in financial planning, because you've got the dual challenge of buying out the incumbent generation and getting the business ready for the incoming generation. So the buyout is a very key transition. It's a very stressful, financially stressful point for the business going forward. And then I thought the last item was most interesting to me when someone wrote in, well, the transition of G3 to take over dad and continue on with their uncle, G2. So when I read that statement, I'm thinking, why is the uncle not transitioning out of the business? This is going to be a very interesting scenario for this family moving forward. The next generation of owners are going to grow our businesses. I consider them to be Oregon's great resource. And anything that we can do to include these young business owners in the Oregon's family business going forward will, I believe, have great rewards for us. In looking at the next generation, 25% of the students on Corvallis campus are from a family business. In fact, 8% of those 4,000 students are shareholders in their family business. So once you find a student who's from a family business, the next question is, well, do you see yourself having a career in the family enterprise going forward? And 47% of those students, quote, strongly disagree. So I understand that 18 to 20-year-olds are, trying to find themselves and differentiate. But my work is to help these young people really understand the opportunities that they have. I find that these students, they demonstrate a stronger work ethic, a higher level of professionalism than I see in their peers. In fact, I look at them on campus in a way similar to people consider student athletes or honor students. I look at the family business students as a very, very important cohort that I'm very excited to be able to cultivate on campus. In terms of the CEO comments, thinking about the next generation, one, of course, next 12 to 24 months, they're going to figure out who will be involved in day-to-day and to change their roles. That, again, it comes back to role definition, which is very important. But also, I was very excited to see the CEO respondent with the next comment in terms of continued development of next gen. So that's very exciting to me because it sounds like there's been some planning and some work, and they're looking forward to continuing it. And so the last point I wanted to make was, I've titled this, business asset transfers grow businesses. So the cost to a family business through estate taxes or gift taxes to transfer the value of the business to the next generation can reduce the capital that's available to the next generation to reinvest. So this is very, very difficult when there's an unexpected death or an unprepared family business, and they experience a death. So these estate taxes can be serious. They have serious business consequences that are ultimately a problem for the employees as well. Now, with planning, farm families that have high land assets and high land values, they are able to use Oregon's natural resource tax credit and conservation easements. I mean, there are tools that are available for them to transfer the value to the next generation. And you can see that these are always top of mind. These are some of our more popular workshops when we're talking about estate taxes, and that is passing from third to fourth generation and the legal tax issues, and then also transition planning and the value transfer. These family business CEOs are clearly trying to set up their next generation with the greatest asset and advantage to be successful in business. So those are some of the comments that I prepared today. I really thank you for the opportunity, and I look forward to your committee recommendations.
Pretty. appreciate this. So we'll get the lights back on here really quick. Questions from the committee? Chair Gromberg.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you, Dr. Knoxall. Good stuff. You're doing good work. And as you well summarized, we at the Capitol can't legislate family harmony. So what can we legislate? I mean, if you were to come to us with the one most important thing that we could do to help family businesses in Oregon legislatively, what might that be?
And I'm not a CPA. I'm not a tax attorney. I'm not an economist. But to the extent that we can give any kind of incentives to our family business owners to conduct their exit planning as part of any of our programs that we provide would be would move us forward in terms of the planning and the conversations that need to happen and help the businesses survive and thrive that transition. I think about one of our Excellence Award-winning family businesses. They took their award and their application to the bank, and they refinanced the interest rate. They got an actual interest rate deduction because they had won this award, and they were able to talk about the impact of the judging and the competition and could demonstrate that they are ready for the next generation. They've done the succession work that they needed to do. You'll find that in the auto industry, right? The franchise is based on a successful succession plan that's been built. So not knowing all of the programs that are available, just at any point that we can be cognizant of the importance of encouraging and motivating and helping those family businesses understand the importance of estate planning is what I would recommend.
Quick follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair. In the various surveys and studies you've done, do you have any sense of what portion of our family-owned businesses are operating without a succession or exit plan or estate plan?
It's over half. It's over half.
Pretty significant.
It is very significant.
Representative.
Thank you so much. What a fascinating presentation. I came from a family business that sold in the fourth generation, which was my generation, so it's no longer family held. But, you know, the issues you describe are so clearly part of the experience of growing up in a family business, so that was fascinating. And I love the idea of encouraging succession planning through some sort of financial incentive. And what I would actually, with your permission, co-chairs, I would love to encourage you to, you know, think about if there are a couple of things legislatively that we could conceivably do, and email us steps do you think the state could realistically do to support positive transitions of businesses, some, you know, within continuing within a family operation, but others, you know, if you need to sell to outsiders too, that's fine too. But it is amazing that 80% of our businesses ish are family owned in Oregon. Mm-hmm. Quite amazing. Thanks.
I have one. Thank you, Co-Chair. Just to follow up on that, thank you again for what you do. Do you have any other plan, or maybe you could include that in your email, mm-hmm. to look at the 5 years coming and know what it is that you might be able to do with this 33% that, and I'm assuming that's above and beyond what you're seeing normally, the 33% that you referenced of family businesses and anticipated leadership change. Have you thought about what that might look like as far as what you're going to do different, or do you have a plan around that?
Well, we have a new dean in the College of Business, so we're really focused on the student experience and getting the next generation prepared. I'm part of a lot of collaborations on campus and working in the ag community. The beginning farm and ranch community and also the agricultural community is recognizing, particularly in those enterprises and food production, how we're really needing to put money and have workshops for those owners. So we've gotten two USDA grants in the past to begin to build some prototype curriculum and workshops. And in fact, this week we'll submit a much more comprehensive program. So we're getting a core base of curriculum, workshops. We're learning about what are the key points and the incentives, what engages the families to come and get started. So we are really focused on that kind of workshop concept. while we have a community who are coming to our breakfasts and kind of connecting, we want to go deeper, and we want to help them, not that we're advising or consulting specifically, but creating that that community and helping them learn from each other. So we're looking at developing out some deeper curriculum going forward. So just to keep moving forward, keep getting the word out. I've been so encouraged in the years that I've been involved, because it's hard to find the family businesses. And once you find them and you have the impact, they tell their peers, who are family businesses. So I'm very excited in what we have going and how we're starting to build that critical mass. Now, are we scaled up for that whole that whole wave of succession that is about to come? I would say not today. The other aspect of our work that's very important that I didn't really touch on is as you educate the families, you need to educate the advisors. You need to have good family facilitators and, you know, good financial planners. So that's another area that we're working in, is getting everybody prepared and understanding the development resources that way. So it's a broad mission. And we're just taking it very carefully and thoughtfully and moving forward. So, yes, 5 years from now, I think we'll have a much deeper bench in terms of our curriculum and our partnerships that we can offer.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Am I correct to assume that you have a business owner that's 20 years old that starts a business, family business, but then they have children, and, of course, 22 years later, they'd like to bring the children into the business? But you were talking about very small businesses, so there's probably no room for them to imbibe those people. So we have a 20-year span here.
Yeah.
That, you know, kind of like, go do your thing and come back. Is mm-hmm. that what's happening?
Yes. The next generation is out. In fact, we encourage them to get experience outside of the family business.
That's a very regular occurrence.
Yeah, that's what I would assume it would be.
So I just want to share an observation. Back in the early 2000s, the estate tax issue was discussed here at the Capitol, and it just became a political mess. You know, the R's were here and the D's were there, and no one could reach consensus. And to me, I guess I'd share committee. To me, this doesn't seem like an R or D issue. To me, it seems like it's just one of those business transition issues. And at some point, perhaps this committee, in partnership with the Revenue Committee, could discuss this to find out if there's a way to, you know, to collaborate and find a win-win that works for the state and works for small business. I think it was brought up in 2001 or 2003, and it just turned into a mess of a debate. And hopefully at some point we can all work together to see what we can do to help all Oregonians with that. So, any other questions or comments? Mr. Chair, we're on time.
Yeah.
We're doing good.
Right on time.
All right. Did you have a comment or question?
Well, while we're changing out panels, Mr. Co-Chair, quick observation. Thank you again, Doctor.
Thank you, Doctor.
And one of the things I learned recently from one of my constituents is that if you want to bring a minor child in to work in your business, that your kids are exempt from child labor laws.
Right.
But your grandchildren are not exempt from child labor laws, which is to say that you can bring your kids in to work in your business, but if you're a little bit older and you have grandchildren, you can't bring your grandkids in. I took a look at that and determined very quickly this is a federal issue, not a state issue,
right.
That did approach our members of our congressional delegation to try and open that up a little bit so you can go to work for grandma and grandpa just as easily as you can for mom and dad.
Yeah, that's something an entrepreneur would know. You hit it right on the head. All right. Thank you. We're going to go to our next panel. Melissa, come on up. Who else? Mitchell? Chad? Welcome. We're glad you're here. So, committee, Melissa Droege is the business development officer over in Eastern Oregon, and I'm going to let her introduce herself, but she covers an area I'm guessing is larger than the state of Rhode Island in geography, maybe half the East Coast when you hear that. So, Melissa, why don't you kick us off, and then what I'm hoping is, because of the important role the three of you play, that we'll have an opportunity to ask lots of questions, if that would be all right.
Okay. Thank you, Co-Chair Gomberg and Co-Chair Smith, for this opportunity and committee.
members. I'm Melissa Druge. I'm the Business Development Officer with Oregon Business Development Department. And as Co-Chair Smith indicated, I'm in the Eastern Region, which is primarily or all rural. I like to say primarily because we're growing, right? And I want to just start by saying or outlining a little bit for you in terms of a business development officer's role in the state agency. We work primarily with existing businesses on retention and expansion. We meet with companies on a regular basis and have for many years, but in the last couple of years, we have formalized that process into a company visit initiative that we've been working with through identifying key companies that we want to meet with that maybe have a large footprint in our region or key industries as defined through our agency. But we put together a list of companies then that we meet with, and those businesses vary in size from what was described earlier as maybe a micro enterprise all the way up to a publicly traded company or industry. So the size really is not what dictates where we're meeting or who we're meeting with. I will say that we do primarily meet with traded sector industry or manufacturing firms. Some of those
so
which
really quick.
Yeah.
I want a little one-on-one. Can you tell me what a traded sector
is? So traded sector would be that widget that is made in but sold outside of the state or country or okay. So that being said, with that in mind, the manufacturing can be from family-owned businesses. So again, it's not so much the type of industry from ownership, but I'm trying to kind of clearly define for you that it's kind of all over in terms of size and ownership and structure of the organization. And obviously, my comments will come primarily from those rural businesses or rural background. And before I go any further, I will let these gentlemen introduce themselves.
Welcome.
Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee. My name is Mitchell G. I'm the Lead Business Development Officer for Business Oregon. I work with Melissa, whereas she covers a very wide amount of range. I have a smaller amount of range, but many, many more people. I cover my home territory is Marion Polk Yamhill, but I also cover Washington and Clackamas counties, and due to a retirement, I'm also covering Crook and Deschutes counties as well. So my job differs slightly from Melissa in the fact that I also deal with trade associations. I spend a lot of time with SEMI, the Semiconductor Trade Association, Unmanned Systems, and in metals manufacturing as well statewide. So being located in the Valley means I get to go to a lot more of those meetings than she gets to go to. So that's about it from the only major differences between what we do. So
welcome.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak with you today. Thank you, Co-Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Smith, for the opportunity. For those that don't know, my name is Chad Freeman. I'm the president of SEDCOR. SEDCOR is Strategic Economic Development Corporation. We're a public-private partnership here in the Mid-Willamette Valley, working on economic development, predominantly traded sector as well, here in Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties. I'll talk a little bit about kind of what we do, as well as some of where recruitment plays a little bit of a role in that as well, and how I think my key theme, I think, throughout this will be partnership and how we all work really closely together.
Perfect. So, Melissa, how do we want to proceed forward? Do you want to share a few thoughts with us, pass the mic around, share a few thoughts, and then we'll ask questions?
I think that sounds good, Co-Chair.
Perfect.
Thanks. So in these business visits, I think I want to clarify that these are not meant to be interviews. We're relationship building with these businesses so that we get an honest dialogue back and forth in terms of the things that they're experiencing or frustrated with or happy with, whatever it is. We try to build a relationship rather than have an interview. But also, that being said, we try to stay on some key points so that we have valid data that we can move forward in opportunities like this to share with you, and also numbers and such as it relates to just general business questions. So as I was going through my list of business retention visits and some of the key challenges that I heard about in my region, I think one of the ones that came up most frequently, at least beginning this year, is the mandatory sick leave. And it was not something that they were complaining about having to do. They felt that that was something that was very fair, that they would offer those employees sick leave. But as you spoke with them and talked to them and asked questions of them, it was clear that they took what they currently had in a handbook, they changed it around, they might have decreased overall days off that might not have been clearly defined as sick leave, and then just moved 5 days over to a mandatory sick leave. Their concern around that, at least for a large majority of the employers that I've met with to date, is that there is room for a fair amount of absenteeism. And when you're in a manufacturing business, you have quotas to meet, production to meet, and trucks to fill to get out on the road and to meet demand. And I went back and looked at some of my notes. I had a couple of employers that even reported as high as a 20% absenteeism on one day. Sunny, beautiful, as they described it, sunny, beautiful Friday. I can't put any validity to any of this, but I can report to you what was at least spoke about. So I think from the standpoint of what I hear from the employers as it relates to this is not so much that it exists, but that there's maybe a lot of room for the employee to be negligent or take advantage of. And one of the things that the major employers are tracking is the use of those days and how many days are going to be left at the end of the year, particularly between that Christmas and New Year's week, because ideally if they have even 25% of their workforce that has the majority of those days remaining, they're very concerned in terms of how they're going to manage that if it becomes an issue on that day. So I bring forth that just as an awareness that I don't hear employers always just complain about we don't want that. They actually offer you know, the very specific pinpoint of the problem and how can we fix it or better it or improve it. So I thought that was worth mentioning because it is something that comes up regularly in at least my conversations. Being in rural Oregon, and this won't be new to you, Co-Chair Smith, in the conversations around workforce and the need for more bodies, availability, reliability, even some skilled workforce. But most of what I'm seeing in terms of my employers out there, the skilled piece maybe isn't as big of an issue because they're willing to train. They've put training in place, maybe some very specific skill levels, but general training, they're handling that. And I think that is what we've seen over a course of years and development, that they've found that they can train in-house affordably, but they've got to have the bodies to do it, and they've got to have reliable, dependable folks. So that is a conversation that goes on frequently throughout. I have a couple of examples of where I'm working with companies around building codes for their expansion, and it's not specific to general building codes, but it's the cost prohibitiveness of the fire suppression piece as it relates to the type of building they may be constructing or the type of industry they are in terms of what their type of business is and the need for fire suppression as they're manufacturing bottled water. And they're not critical of the fact that they have to have regulation. They respect that piece of it. They're wanting to see that that is being something that they can look at and negotiate and work through and problem solve. And so there may be something there in the future. There's nothing specific at this time, but it was interesting to me that at least in my region, there's two that I'm working with currently. And the other one was around the type of building. It was 100% cement building. Because of its size, the fire suppression piece was dictating what was needed there. And those costs are fairly fairly expensive.
Yeah. Co-chair.
Thank you. Excuse me for interrupting, but before we leave the topic of fire suppression, is the savings in insurance premiums factored into those conversations? You're talking about the overall cost of implementing fire suppression?
I think, I know in the one example with the cement building, I believe that it was. And the other one I could not speak to one way or the other, co-chair. But I think in this, in my bringing this up again, I don't think this is necessarily something that is, you know, I right now we're working through it. We're getting through that. We're figuring out how to put in a firewall. And you know, even in the water bottling company, you have product that is flammable. And if that's separated off and, you know, so there's parts and pieces of this that are being worked through, but they're looking at it from initial investment of $350,000 and we want to put in a, you know, 5,000 square foot expansion, which is what puts them over and requiring that. So I appreciate the question.
Thank you, Mr. Coacher.
You bet.
Let's see. And lastly, I guess I would just talk briefly, at least in rural Oregon, we have a fair amount of businesses that look at expansion and growth. And if they're heavily reliant on a public utility such as electricity or natural gas, that sometimes is prohibitive. And working through those costs and who pays for those costs from the standpoint of that expansion is oftentimes put on the business. And that's a conversation that businesses always are asking me, you know, what can we be doing for that? Again, you know, it's they're public, they're private utility companies. So for them to make that type of investment is, you know, it's a negotiation between the company and the community in which they're expanding in and that public or private utility. But it is something that comes up in conversation a lot in the sense that some expansions have been put on hold because of that inability to absorb that cost for that need for expansion on the utility. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mitchell, and he can add to those comments.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah, okay. Please.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Thank you. Love your knowledge. When you talk about the dialogue that you have with business owners, I'm really curious. I know you mentioned paid sick leave, workforce, a few different things. What is the, if you could pick one or two, what's the most that you hear across the board as something that holds businesses back or that they're frustrated with? And in those one or two, what can we do to make that better for them?
This is a conversation that Co-Chair Smith and I have had numerous times. And honestly speaking, the number one thing is workforce. And honestly speaking, if any one of us in this room had the answer today, we would be
that.
The hero.
Yeah.
I appreciate that question because I think it's one of the things that our regional solutions team is looking at and trying to explore. You know, even if you chip away at the rock, eventually you have the pebbles and you can and do something with them and move the pile over. The same with workforce. I don't think we can attack any one thing at any one time. And I know last year we had a huge push and effort for career technical education as it relates to the skills piece. And we're seeing that come alive in the sense that our community colleges are picked up programs, bricks and mortar are being built, and industries are partnering for that curriculum. And I think that's a win. I think that's something that we're going to get to come back and report to this committee and to the legislature as a whole to say, you know, this is what we were able to do with the funds that were put out there for that piece. So again, I think the problem is really big and it's vast and broad, but I think we just have to keep chipping away at it and addressing small bits and pieces of it.
Can I ask just one little follow-up? Yeah. When you talk about workforce, one of the things that we've heard that we need to address also, it's not just a workforce or a trained workforce, but it's also a workforce that has soft skills,
yes,
meaning you have to work 8 hours a day. You can't be on your cell phone. You have to actually show up. And so can you, is that an issue? And then, you know, if flexible scheduling came into play, what would that do to people?
Yes, it is an issue. And I think it's an issue statewide, and I think it's an issue across the country. So I think we're right on target in discussing soft skill. And interestingly enough, and I'm glad you asked the question because it reminded me of a conversation I had with a key employer in my region that employs over 2,000 people just in my region alone in a couple of different plants. And they're actually looking at this as a team, and they're looking at this from a standpoint of, you know, the regular shift work 8 to 5 or graveyard or split shift or whatever that looks like is not necessarily appealing to our millennials, as they call themselves and others have tagged them. And they actually have a management team that's working with some of their millennials to talk about what is your ideal work structure look like, knowing that we have these goals to meet. We have production goals to meet, and we have to meet those production goals. And in order to do that, we have to have bodies working. So keeping that in mind, XYZ employee, what should your work schedule look like? And so these conversations are just starting. But this is something that I learned last month in one of my visits, that their management team has come together and human resources has said, listen, we have to have a serious conversation about this because we have to have 2,000 plus employees in Eastern Oregon. And where are they going to come from? And we want to grow, and our industry is growing, and we don't want to be dictating our sales and our growth by the ability to attract workforce. So I think it's forward thinking. And one of the things that I use these opportunities with my businesses is that I ask those businesses in a generic format if I can share that information, not only with committee members like yourself, but also with other businesses to kind of plant that seed. And one of the things I did last year was asked my employers, when's the last time you invited your workforce investment representative out to tour your plant so that they understand your employment needs? Because one of the things they were seeing was that their referrals weren't necessarily as useful as they wanted them to be. And I actually had two employers come back and thank me for that suggestion. They invited their workforce employment department, came, toured, understood their needs, and they're getting great referrals from that, from the Oregon State Employment. So it was one small thing that just happened in terms of being able to share information generically with between companies as we meet.
Thank you. So Mitchell, we're going to have you go as you're taking a moment to share with us. I want to make sure the committee understands our business development officers are unique, and that they're really the frontline face for the state of Oregon when it comes to meeting with business and industry. And I hope in our next 25 minutes you'll just take a few minutes just to talk about a little more about that breadth. How one day you might be with a Fortune 500 company, mm-hmm. even a Fortune 200 company, and then the next day you're meeting with a ma business, not even a ma and pa business, but a ma business, and that role you play in my view, that executive role you play for the state of Oregon. So anyway, I don't want to take away from your thunder, but I'm hoping you'll mix that in a little bit with your comments.
Thank you. No, absolutely. That's a great lead-in. And I'm going to continue along the lines that Melissa started, because she referred to our priority company initiative, going out and meeting with companies in each of the region and getting feedback. We are in year two of that. And if you take a look at the year one data that we collected, one of the biggest challenges, if not the biggest challenge, was workforce. I started with the agency a little over 4 years ago. When I started, I worked with SEDCOR, so I'm housed with SEDCOR. This was prior to Chad. He was actually still sitting in my chair at the time. Was working with the SEDCOR team, and they did a little survey of their membership. And even here in the Mid-Willamette Valley 4 years ago, they had between 250 and 300 open positions. 4 years ago, when the unemployment rate was still over 6.5%, 7%, somewhere in that range. And it will all boil down to workforce. And so the data we've been collecting goes to that workforce piece. By illustration, how companies have decided to move forward on this. I work with a company out of McMinnville, aerospace supply company, very successful. They're actually based out of the UK. When I started 4 years ago, they brought me in and said, we just want to let you know what we're doing. We are working with Yamhill Carleton High School. We are rebuilding their shop program. They went in and they've spent almost $400,000 of their corporate funds to strip down the entire building, rebuild all the machines, bring in new computer systems for the students, hire the shop teacher to come work in the summertime in their facility to understand what the requirements are, and then mentor the students. They first went to McMinnville High School and were turned down. They are now moved on from Yamhill Carleton High School, and they're working with another high school because they have to have that workforce pipeline, and they could not find it. They are very aggressive and very focused on making sure that they have this pipeline. This company is a phenomenal company, but they've had to do it themselves because they didn't feel that there was a great network out there for them. So it's a great illustration. They're open to conversation, so if this is something that the committee would like to learn more about, I'm sure that they would be willing to speak about it. And they have grown their influence substantially. I don't know if CTEC here in Salem will give them credit, but they did steal one of the people that helped with Yamhill Carleton High School is now working to help manage CTEC here in Salem. So it's a great program. But workforce is really the key. And I find that in my companies across industries and across sizes. It could be the family-owned small business of sub 10 up to this company has 350 employees. It doesn't matter what industry they're in. It's all the quality of the workforce. So, and that's the biggest piece. And Representative Smith, as you stated, it does depend. Our interface goes all over the place. Mm-hmm. So in my role in the Mid-Willamette Valley, I deal with an aerospace company. I also deal with the semiconductor companies, the capital equipment companies. I used to work for a company out of Tualatin called Novellus System, semiconductor capital equipment. I had breakfast with the site manager up there who now has 1,800 employees reporting to him in Tualatin plus another couple thousand in San Jose. He has the same issues. He needs workforce. Mm-hmm. It's they just need people to be able to be there to do the work. All the way down to the company that I worked last week, I spent some time with Marcia Bagnell, the SBDC director here in Salem. We were going over spreadsheets for a young lady who wants to start a Latino-based bakery in Salem. And we were going over spreadsheets and basic information. We depending on the day, it could be a single sole proprietorship, or it could be, like I said, a large company, which is my former employer. So it's quite the ride as a business development officer. So
I was going to have Representative Esquivel. Did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very pleased to see that we are expanding into the in what I call it the blue collar professions. Mm-hmm. You know. We went wayward with our education system with the educators because they put such an emphasis on college that they left out 82% of the population that didn't finish college because 82% of the people that enter high school did not graduate out of college. So therefore, we excluded those people. And I think Representative Schaffer summed it up well when he said, you can have as many people as you want being the engineer, but who's going to build the bridge? Very good question. Mm-hmm. I think that we have done some things, and I'm happy to hear that the private sector is doing some things as well, because that's so important. We kind of have a joke in Southern Oregon, do you want to hire a plumber or do you want to hire a neurosurgeon? The answer is the neurosurgeon, because availability is better and it's cheaper. And that's just about the truth, you know. But these blue-collar jobs must be emphasized in the school as not as a derogatory situation like they were being cast as, but as a true profession, because they are a profession and they are very good. Electricians, sheet metal workers, welders, plumbers, you know, the whole gamut there. And these are the people that make America what America really is.
That's a good point. And maybe one of the things our committee should be thinking about as we start looking at next session is how do we collaborate with the education committee and our labor committee and this committee on this workforce development and what we can be doing to sustain it and make sure we're all collaborating together. Mitchell, I didn't want to take away from any other comments you had.
No, I think I've gone down that workforce far enough. Okay. I thought I'd pass it over to Chad to give him a few minutes to talk about the recruitment side and the public-private partnership side.
Mr. Co-Chair, before we leave, Mr. G, I'm just looking at the map here. So there's a vacancy in the dark green area in the middle of Oregon right now?
Yeah, there's actually a couple of vacancies on that map. So our representative that covered the metro area, that really covered Washington and Clackamas counties, has resigned quite some time ago, that has not been refilled yet. And we also have Clark Jackson from Central Oregon retired as of June 30th. So we are scrambling. I know Melissa has taken up some of Clark's region. I've taken up some of it, and our counterpart in the metro region that has Multnomah County out the gorge is also taking up part of it. So,
because Melissa didn't have enough turf already.
No, not at all. And then we also have our Southern Oregon coast has been out on medical leave, so we've had to shift that direction as well. So,
you know, and Mr. Co-Chair, that's a great observation. You know, Melissa, I believe you're headquartered out of La Grande. And so, you know, colleagues, if you look at that orange stripe on the right, it could take her upwards of, 7-8 hours to get to a community to serve a business. And I think about, look at that yellow strip. My goodness, if you were in Josephine County and you had to get to Burns, you're easily 2 to 3 day trip.
In the summer.
That's a good point.
During the winter, right? That's right.
Let's Larry and I, we work together on Burns. If I'm on a day, I go to Burns for him. It's just 70 miles.
Yeah, just a mere 70, representative.
Thank you, Co-Chair. So is there a reason the positions have not been filled? Is it lack of workforce?
I was going to say
that's a very good question, and I think that's one you might want to talk to the director about.
Got it.
Because obviously there's a lot of things that go on.
The one thing I'll share on this, and colleagues, please know, I have a lot of relationship with our business development officer, is these are unique positions, because you want folks who understand the community, understand the leadership, understand what's going on in workforce and community college, and all the way down to what's going on in kindergarten. You want your business development officers to know their communities, and sometimes it's a struggle to find that right person who could really integrate in. Not meaning to take up too much time, we're really blessed with Melissa, because she knows the timber industry, she knows the cattle, she knows value-added agriculture, and to find someone who can come in and talk that language with that clientele isn't always easy. Just as if I'd have a nightmare of a time if I showed up into Hillsboro trying to talk high tech, I couldn't do it. And so it's difficult finding that level of executive expertise. So. Sir, welcome.
Great. Thank you so much. And it's kind of fun to segue in off the business development, because when I was approached about speaking a little bit about recruitment, I think the core thing with economic development is folks oftentimes think of recruitment, but it really is based on the business development and those ongoing relationships. And I think that's one of the key pieces of where the economic development and where the system really is, and to make sure we understand, is that the recruitment is always based on your existing book of business, for lack of a better term. I know started with saying I'm president here of SEDCOR, and when we look at our results over the last 3 years, 85% of our results in terms of new investment and new jobs come out of existing companies. And I think we can all look at that and know that those are almost across the board going to be small businesses. that is who we are at our core, and those are the groups of folks that we're working with. So then if 85% of our results do come from the retention expansion work that we do, the other piece of it, then there's two other pieces. Obviously, innovation is a key role in building the new economy. But recruitment does fill another need. And so the questions we get is, well, if there's 85% of your existing work comes, then why are we doing recruitment? And I think for me, it's pretty clear, but it's also it's a great question, because the advantages that recruitment are going to bring are new ideas, new capital, potentially new supply chains as well that we can come in and help, or that recruitment of that company who can help our existing industry. So when I think about that, you know, one of the recent projects that we've had the luxury of working with here in the Mid-Willamette Valley was a partnership really with NORPAC, who's a big co-op locally, supports 1,200 employees directly, plus over 200 farmers, and they've been around since the early 1900s. And in working with them in conversations similar to what my colleagues here have said, realized that they've got a cold storage issue. Where do we put our goods and services before we can get it to market? As we expanded that conversation, that really was an industry-wide across the agricultural industry here in the Mid-Willamette Valley. That was a problem. So NORPAC and SEDCOR and many other partners, the state, the city, joined in partnership. Henningsen Cold Storage, a local company out of Hillsboro, fifth generation now organization, did a joint venture with NORPAC, did a $30 million investment that then reached capacity so fast that we then broke ground again last week on their second one. This is an example of a new company coming into the region to help supply chain that supports an entire industry. And I think when we think about recruitment, that's really what we're looking at as well. How do we help our existing companies continue to grow and continue to build our communities? And there's one other piece I think that's important to think on that recruitment is, how do we help our communities? And ultimately, when you think about economic development, that's what we are. We're in the business of trying to build those communities. How do we help them transition? How do we help them build new industries? And you look at some of the work, some of our colleagues at work, had the opportunity to speak with Roger Lee in Central Oregon, and some of the work he did with Lance Air. And they came in, and now Bend is a hub for aerospace, something, you know, 50 years ago, I don't think anybody would have guessed. Amy's Kitchen in Medford, some of that work that came by. Those are really the key, I think, when you think about recruitment and what the goal is. It's those industries that are coming in. But again, I'm tying it back to the business development piece. One of the projects here that Mitchell spoke about briefly was the CTEC, the Career Training and Education Center here, which is a joint partnership, local private investor, partnered with the Salem-Keizer School District. The state has been a huge supporter of that as well, to bring in a manufacturing curriculum as well as a construction curriculum to teach those soft skills that Representative Hack mentioned as well. Been a great success story. They're graduating the first students, and we're seeing those guys and girls get hired right after graduation. These are folks coming out at 18 with those good high school skills, good skills around construction, and as well as knowing what's expected of them. In fact, part of their curriculum is building a business plan and making sure it proves out. So a big piece, again, tying into how the development piece continues to work with that recruitment piece. So
one of the questions I have on recruitment, and again, colleagues, please know I work with Melissa over in Eastern Oregon, so I want to be very transparent. But are there opportunities as we're doing recruitment to find other opportunities to help small business? For example, I know Melissa worked with it's a very public company. The legislature put a few million dollars into it. It's EP Minerals, very public. This public information. But Melissa was instrumental in helping a small business pick up a contracting opportunity with this company. And I know she can't go into that, but do you see there's opportunities as we're recruiting industry into Oregon to help tie that recruitment in with procurement opportunities or contracting opportunities or sales opportunities? And I don't know if you could just take a few minutes and talk about that.
Absolutely. And I think in many cases you'll see on the recruitment side, that's actually going to be something that many companies we work with are looking with. How do we build our local connections? One, it's good business sense. It's if you're going to have somebody in your supply chain, having them be next door where you can go through and work through a business issue or collaborate on talent or on that next big idea, I think is absolutely integral and something that we see really across the gamut of what we do. The other piece, you can keep your costs lower because transportation, goods and services in and out, it really is something that we do and we encourage. Again, I mentioned that the Henningsen project, I think a good example of those folks are now working with other local providers that need to get their goods and services across the U.S. But how do we get it out of the field, add our value into it and then store it for distribution, for storage, or integrate our two processes together? Absolutely integral. And I think the other example, and we mentioned, or Mitchell mentioned earlier, work with the semiconductor industry in the Portland, in the metro area. But you look at the kind of really the impact of when I think of it, Intel came here as a recruitment project in the late 70s, has gone through steady growth since then. But now you want to look at the supply chain that's built in, mm-hmm. because folks are, existing companies are feeding into that, existing talent is continuing to grow there, and you've got whole industries around there. I think that really does feed into those.
I'd just like to add a comment to that off of Chad. Part of it, from the business development officer perspective, is our technical assistance to those small companies and to those large companies is to help them network to find that supply chain. So we spend a lot of time with trade associations just to help them and say, what problems are you having? Do you need help finding this machine shop? Okay, I can't tell you one, but I can tell you 20.
So let me ask a very pointed question. Well, I'm not going to ask a pointed question. What I'm going to do is compliment the new director in making sure that our BDOs are part of that recruitment process in being involved in that, and that our local economic development folks are part of that. Because I really think that there's a role for you folks and your individual responsibilities to be key in recruiting business to Oregon, because you're going to have information that perhaps recruitment officers for the state of Oregon, while at a high level they serve a role, may not be able to answer at the local level. And so I know the director's committed to making that happen, and so I want to compliment him. So, colleagues, I've done too much talking here. Any other questions from Representative Lively?
Thank you, Co-Chair. So, unfortunately, having been a business development officer, the first in the state of Oregon, and also served in the role that you're in for many years in Lane County, so I want to go back a little bit and talk about these visits, which I think are great ideas, and how you connect them back to the local communities, because in many cases, counties and or cities, and I'm sure you hear that when you're out there meeting with businesses, counties and or cities are an impediment or a complement to people expanding in that. And so I'm trying to understand, because not in every area do we have a SEDCOR. Mm-hmm. In some cases, we don't have those. And so as you're meeting with businesses in your role there, how does that relate to the communities that ultimately, the county, the city, the issues, the permits, does all those other things that are part of businesses expanding?
So with our business visits, we actually invite our local partners to come with us. One of the things we respect is the business owner's time. It's limited, and we all want to gather the same kinds of information to provide better service or connectivity for that business to be able to thrive, prosper, and grow. And so if that's the local economic partner, that's we've had workforce representatives come with us. We've had city and county representatives come with us. We've had regional coordinator from the governor's office, other regional solutions team members. And we just let the company know we're bringing XYZ people with us because based on our last visit, you talked about these key things, and we think these people might be able to assist in other areas as related to our last conversation. Or we have a follow-up meeting and bring those people along and make the introduction. So I think it's an important role that we play in terms of sometimes just matchmaking.
Thank you.
If I can follow up with a quick comment. The majority of our work is to listen to the small business because we're not the ones driving this. They are. So we want to listen to find out what they need from us. And it is that matchmaking piece. And Melissa is exactly right. It's if we can use our networks to help that company that we're visiting, we'll do it. That's what we're here for, be it on the private side or the government side.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions? Folks, we appreciate it. Please send our best to Director Harder. I think I said Sean, that was the last director. But we appreciate Chris and all the work he's doing. Appreciate all the good work you folks are doing. And let's just keep collaborating and working together.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We are now 4 minutes ahead of schedule. John, come on up. So we're going to have John Saros from Business Oregon. He's Business Services Manager. Is that the title? Yep.
Same one.
Yes. Same one. Come on up. We're glad you're here. So, welcome. So what we're going to do is we're going to let you introduce yourself. We've got 20 minutes on the agenda.
Thank you very much, Chair Smith, Chair Gomberg. For the record, my name is John Saros, Business Services Manager at Business Oregon. And primarily what we do here in the Business Services section is administer a suite of development finance programs that help support small businesses access capital that they need to grow, expand operations, and oftentimes retain businesses and employees here in our state. What I've been asked to do today is give you a brief overview of those programs and then ultimately talk to you a little bit about how businesses access these programs around the state. As I mentioned, we do have a suite of programs. They're kind of in three categories. We have direct loans, where we lend money out to businesses and they repay the program or the fund principal and interest. We have insurance programs that insure loans that banks and credit unions make. And then what we have are called private activity bonds, which provides lower cost financing to eligible projects. And so I'll run through those various programs real briefly, again, very high level. And feel free to ask me questions along the way. I know you may have some. And then we'll talk a little bit about the marketing and outreach that occurs with the programs. As a finance group, what we do with these businesses is we really work with them from before application a lot of times. We do underwriting depending on the program. We'll actually create notes and agreements, close the loan, fund them, and then ultimately we're going to do collection work as well, so ensure that the loans are repaid and if we need to go through asset liquidation, which actually doesn't occur very often. So that's some of the nuts and bolts. The programs really have a couple of core common goals. Number one, obviously, help businesses access the capital they need. Secondarily, it would be to complement private financing. The role of the state in many of these programs is to help private lenders make more money available to small businesses. Next, it would be to improve the overall health, financial health, and well-being of the companies that are coming to Business Oregon. We want to help transition them out to being bankable so that they aren't relying on public financial resources in order to obtain credit. We do support traded sector activities with a lot of our programs, but then too we do have programs that do support retail and service oriented businesses because those are very important, especially in our rural communities. We really focus and specifically target small businesses. We'll kind of talk about the programs real briefly and tell you about the size, and you'll really quickly see on average between 5 and 20 employees is what you're going to see in these programs. Since inception, Oregon is in a very unique position. We've had programs available since the mid-80s. These have been very well thought out programs, have high success rates, and there's entities around the country, including Council of Development Finance Agencies and also U.S. Treasury, that's actually acknowledged the state of Oregon and how we administer these. There's been about 4,800 projects funded with $2.5 billion in funding made available, which has impacted over 38,000 jobs since inception. So with that, we'll dive into the programs. We'll start first with direct loans. Again, these are loans that are made to businesses who then repay them, much like you would a bank or a bank loan or a mortgage. The first loan is called the Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund. This particular program really focuses and targets primarily on entrepreneurial startups. In order to qualify, you have to have less than $500,000 in revenues. What we see really is that probably 80% of these companies are starting up for the first time. This is the capital that they're using to open their doors, get inventory, do tenant improvements, and just have the working capital they need to ramp up sales and grow them. The loans in this program, these qualify for any industry sector. So you could be a retailer or service business or traded sector. Typically, they're smaller loans. Businesses can qualify up to $100,000 in financing that's repaid. Most loans are over 5 years. The rates on those are fixed. They're 5.5% right now, which is a very low rate. Most of the businesses that do access this fund, though, typically are having a difficult time accessing capital through the private lending markets. Banks and credit unions want to help small businesses, but that's first starting before they have 24 to 36 months of operation is very often difficult. We've partnered with the Small Business Development Center along with a number of other technical assistance providers around the states. One of the things that was identified with this program early on is that the failure rate was incredibly high. Well, what was missing? Well, technical assistance. Are these businesses, they have a business plan, have they been vetted, they have the right management team and resources around them? And so with the addition of those providers, failure rates dramatically reduced. This program, on average, the companies when they apply have about 1.5 FTE, so relatively small companies. Average loan size is about $30,000. Average project size is about $55,000. So they're putting in some of their own equity and resources into the project. Loans are typically processed in 2 to 3 weeks from complete application. So that's our first program. The second direct loan program is the Oregon Business Development Fund. This is a program that really truly targets traded sector. I was created in the mid-80s and really was designed to help support the manufacturing industry where there's a greater return on investment back to the state. These loans can be a bit bigger. We can make loans up to $1 million, but they are made in partnership with financial institutions. Typically, the state's loan represents less than 40% of the eligible project costs. So private lending and owner equity is usually involved in this. Rates are typically fixed. Right now we're at a 4% rate, which is a very reasonable rate. And historically what this has done is offered a lower cost of financing to make the project more feasible. The state typically takes a subordinate lien position. So that means that the private lender has a priority lien on the collateral, whether that's real estate or equipment. We would have a junior lien. That gives the lender more assurance that they're going to be able to get repaid if there is a default. So I'm trying to think what we have. When we process a loan, again, small business focused, average is less than 20 FTE. The state's loan is typically about $300,000 or less, and the overall project is about $1 million. So that kind of gives you a little bit of the scale of the borrowers that we work with. We do have one newer pilot program that is a loan program that we've been managing. Through OBDF, the Oregon Business Development Loan Fund, our loss rate has been very low, actually sub 2%, which if you compare that to the private lending world, they would have been really pleased with that, especially dragging through the recession. One of the things that has come up a number of times is the state taking on enough risk. Well, what we've tried to do is identify a program where there's some additional risk to be taken. It's targeted, and ultimately there will be a higher rate of return to offset some of the risk. And what this particular program does is it targets traded sector businesses, again, that are high growth, high potential for growth, but it provides capital that's really more between an angel and VC stage and a commercial credit stage in their business continuum. So
what is it? Does that just mean less collateral?
Sometimes it can mean less collateral or no collateral. And primarily what we're working with are companies that need a pretty significant infusion of working capital. Mm-hmm. They need it to ramp up marketing. They've already gone through proof of concept. So they've prototyped. They're ready for market. They've identified part of what their market niche is, but they're having a tough time raising that capital to get them scaled. This is, again, a pilot program. We've made really three loans through this particular pilot. The risk is mitigated in part by sharing revenues. So we get a portion of their gross sales as opposed to a high interest rate. What that does is allow the state to get made whole and get paid out at a higher rate of return as the business gets successful rather than just charging a 20% interest rate from day one. So again, it's a new pilot program and we've got a couple of loans that have been made since rolling that out in December.
What's your initial take on that? Do you feel comfortable sharing that? Is there a promise in this, or is this one we're going to have to watch real carefully?
I think that there honestly is a tremendous market for this type of financing out there. One of the ways that we are working to promote the program is working with various venture and angel conferences around the state. As they look at their pool of applicants in there, there's a lot of companies that don't scale towards an exit that angel and VC investors are looking for. So an angel or VC investment is typically looking for a 5 to 10% return on what they invest in a company. The way that we've kind of projected our model, we're probably between 1.8 and 2 times the investment. So it's a much lower rate of return. Not diluting ownership allows the company to stay here. And ultimately, if we can provide them growth capital, they're going to scale rapidly.
Thank you.
So that wraps up our loan programs for direct loans. We do, as I mentioned, have loan insurance programs. There's two of these. They both work with banks and credit unions. In order to qualify for this program, you have to be a regulated financial entity. The difference is that one program insures individual loans that a bank makes. The other one insures portfolios of loans that are enrolled into the program. The first program that we'll talk about, one point that's needs to be pointed out on these is that the bank sets the rates and terms. Those aren't approved by the they're accepted by the state, but we don't get engaged in that particular part of the loan process. To start with, our capital access program, this is the loan portfolio insurance program. So typically how this program works is a bank would identify a loan that falls outside of their risk profile. They would charge a fee to the borrower to enroll it into the program. And then the state would match or double match depending on where the project is, and that those proceeds are put into a loan loss reserve account. If the company ever defaults and the bank or financial institution credit union is unable to collect from the security, they then can go to the loan loss reserve and get made whole. So on average, those are small loans. Banks and credit unions that do this have very targeted client profiles that they pursue. They can be industry specific, or they can be startup, or very early stage companies. The average loan enrolled is about $54,000, and the average total project is about $100,000. And the companies typically have fewer than 2 employees at the time of application. The next program, our credit enhancement fund, this is the one where banks and credit unions would approach the state through an application process and request insurance on the specific transaction that they're working on. Typically, what we're looking for or looking at in this particular case is our larger projects. We're able to provide guarantees up to $2 million in state exposure on term loans and up to $1.5 million on operating lines of credit. The intent really of this is to help, again, companies that aren't quite bankable get the capital that they need in order to continue to grow and expand. The pricing on that loan program is between 1.5% and 3%, depending on the term of the insurance provided. And we work through the bank and specifically review their underwriting and also help establish criteria that would ensure repayment of the loan. Mm-hmm. That program has probably been our most active program over the last 4 or 5 years as lenders are really looking to help, especially as we came out of the recession, and now they're looking at business expansion and growth.
So do you find that those programs compete or complement, say, programs from SBA and USDA that provide not identical but similar type coverage?
Coach Eric, great question. We actually find that while some of the programs have similar structures to the SBA and USDA, we consistently hear back from the lenders that use it that this is a much simpler program to use. We're typically working with community banks and credit unions that don't have a large infrastructure that's usually necessary to comply with ongoing SBA performance requirements. So these are products that are really compatible to the underwriting that the bank does. They make sense, and they can monitor them along with their conventional underwriting.
And I think I'd add to your comment that I think relationships get developed between the department and your small commercial banks, community banks,
right.
And those relationships tend to carry for years, and it helps in that overall lending experience. Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Co-Chair, and thank you, Mr. Sarris. My observations are that in spite of all your good work, that most microbusiness startups are relying on self-funding. They're using their savings, their credit cards, or their home equity. Is the issue that they're not aware of all the various programs that are out there, or that they don't qualify for most of the programs that are out there, or am I wrong in my premise, and that they're that we were having much better penetration than I happen to observe?
I'm sorry.
Actually, that's a great observation. I would say that 95% of businesses are bootstrapping themselves right now. A lot of that, is to some extent awareness. I think that a lot of times when business owners get into business, it's because they're passionate about what it is that they want to do and may not necessarily have thought through the entire process. This is where, you know, partnerships with entities like the Small Business Development Center and other technical assistance providers around the state are helpful.
And not meaning to add to that, but Noah, correct me if I'm wrong, you're not up here, but that's part of the role you play is to help small business learn about these programs and to make those connections.
So, no, that's fine. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So how can we do a better job of getting the word out? Mr. Co-Chair, I hope the word goes out that I'm going to keep asking this question. We're fascinated by what you are doing, but we want to know what we can do. What can we do better to help these programs succeed?
I think that raising the visibility and profile of the programs is probably the number one thing. I was going to talk about this a little later on, but happy to do it now. We regionally market to areas around the state, much like the business development officers and networks. I think if there is an opportunity, and part of this is for us internally, to do a better job working with local newspapers and things like that to write op-ed pieces, potentially informing the public about additional resources that may be available. And it's doing things like that. We don't per se have marketing dollars. That's not something that's built into our budgets. So we have to rely on our partnerships and our partners that we do have, whether it's banks, credit unions, regional economic development partners, small business development center network, et cetera. But I think it's just the smaller things of being more engaged from in areas where the public has more viewability.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Is the money that you have access to generally fully deployed, or do we have an issue of, you know, really only partial deployment, and so the fact that people don't know to access your services is having a significant impact?
Representative Benders of the committee, that's a great question in that there's a lot of the loans that are made by the department or that are enrolled in these programs typically are countercyclical to the economy. So as the economy gets more difficult, there's usually increased demand on these types of programs and resources. Right now, conversely, we are seeing a very competitive private lending market where there is less reliance mm-hmm. on government programs to help extend credit. So right now, I would say to some extent, there is some underutilization of the funds. But again, that's a trend that we've seen repeatedly as economic trends ebb and flow. I think that there are opportunities to continue to find more innovative ways to deploy the capital. The Small Business Expansion Fund is an example of that, where we're taking some idle resources, if you will, dedicating them to a different market or opportunity to see if there's more and better ways to get the funds deployed. On average, though, so like our Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund, we have about $1.5 million available. Our Capital Access Program, we probably have the capacity to enroll maybe $3 or $4 million in loans. Our other direct lending program, we probably have about $10 million of capital available. So there is opportunity, but it's not a significant portion of assets that are just sitting idly at this point. And I hope that addressed your question to some extent.
May I ask a follow-up?
Please.
So is it like half are deployed, or 30%, or 75%?
I would say that right now we probably have between 65 and 70% of assets deployed.
Thanks.
Or leveraged in some fashion.
That was really helpful. The countercyclical part was very helpful, too. Thanks.
Thank you.
Representative Blythe.
Thank you, Co-Chair. So I'd like to explore a little bit more of this insurance or that's an interesting concept that I wasn't aware years ago when I was doing this business that was there. So I think it's a great. So what's the limitation or? So I understand in loan programs we have a dollar amount limit there, but what's the limitation, or is there a limitation from the standpoint that allows you to either do it or not from the standpoint of the total pot, the risk the state will take? Is it coming from someplace else? I'm just trying to understand what drives it. I think it's a great program, frankly.
Representative, member of the committee, the loan guarantee program actually has a pool of cash, if you will, that is sitting in reserve to help offset any risk that the state potentially has. At this time today, we have approximately $20 million of cash that is in that reserve. Typically, what states and other people that administer these guarantee programs will do is they will set a benchmark for how highly that can be leveraged. Okay. In Oregon right now today, we have about 3-to-1 leverage on that. So we have about $60 million of exposure against our $20 million of cash. We ultimately, and this gets back to the capacity of the program, we could probably do another $20 million of exposure given the risk profile of the entire portfolio. There also is some good faith behind the state that's backing it. We've never had to call on it or rely on it. And we've actually always managed to risk or to the cash that's in the program. Just as a follow-up point, most of the programs we administer are what are called evergreen, which means that they generate enough income mm-hmm. to support operations and losses. So we're not reliant on ongoing legislative appropriations to continue to fund these. They're other funded, provided that we continue to manage the credit risk, we'll continue to have programs long into the future here in the state.
So that might.
Please.
So, and I probably should know this, but I'm going to. So, the $20 million. So, at some point, you came to the legislature and the legislature agreed to set the count up, or did those funds come from proceeds from something else that you put into that?
The proceeds in our loan guarantee program right now, we have about $6 million that has been provided by the legislature through lottery bonds, and this was done in the late 90s and early 2000. We have $13.5 million that was provided by U.S. Treasury through a program that actually will be sunsetting at the end of this year, and provided we do what we need to do, we'll retain those and the rest of its program income.
Very good. Thank you.
So when I hear you say other funds, that's interest income, fee income, and interest income off of deposit.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
That's awesome. Representative Busbaugh.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I see a kind of a pattern with us. We try to provide services for people, yet we don't seem to have the ability or the programs in place to let people know about the programs. So. I'm going to go back and say it would be nice if the people that have spoken here today came in with a plan on how to do that. Because the one thing I've learned in life, it's very hard to sell a secret. So I would suggest that you come in with a plan for this committee. Because it's like Co-Chair Gromberg said, it's great to know what you've done, but we need to have solutions. We need to have alternatives. We need to have different ways of where we can help people. And it reminds me of the veterans. You have 330,000 veterans in the state of Oregon, as Chair Lively knows from the Veterans Committee. 30,000 are getting the benefits. We're leaving 300,000 on the table. And again, it's hard to sell a secret. And most veterans you talk to, they don't have a clue what their benefits are. And I think maybe that's part of the problem.
Yeah, so I would share, co-chair and representative, I hope those higher up in Business Oregon are hearing this message, because that really is a concern that's coming from our committee. Is we know good work's being done, we applaud it, we're trying to figure out how do we get that word out to all Oregonians, and whether it's your program or SBDC's, we've got to figure out how do we get that word out. I just have one more thought, and then I want to move on. I know you've got lending partners out there that manage small revolving loan funds. They're all over the state of Oregon. I wonder if there's an opportunity to partner with them to purchase some of their good loans, freeing up capital for them to go and continue lending. There's an organization, I have no affiliation with it, but it's called Northeast Oregon Economic Development District, and they're at about 98% loaned out. Their loan portfolio has zero losses, hasn't had a loss in a decade. And probably many of those loans, if you were using traditional banking terms, could be purchased. And I wonder if there's an opportunity for the state to collaborate with groups like that, freeing up capital that they then can continue to loan into their local community. It's not direct lending by the state, right, but it's the state partnering with these folks. And I know that thought's been discussed in the past, but I don't know if it's ever gone anywhere.
I actually, a couple really quick things. I think that there's the possibility to look at ideas like that, using existing programs and resources. If we took something like the Oregon Business Development Fund, the issue that we would have right now is that they need to meet all of the statutory eligibility criteria, advance rates, et cetera. So there would need to be some additional flexibilities made to allow us to look at doing that. I think that the program is already designed to look at being able to have documentation assigned or something like that, or work out a servicing arrangement.
Is that something you folks could go back and take a look at? Because there's some fast-growing communities in Oregon where their revolving loan funds are maxed out, and yet there's, you know, as this economy grows, there is going to be an opportunity for them to gap finance. And as Chair Gomberg always shares, we want the solutions. We want, and I don't know if there is one there or not. And if there isn't, just tell us.
Absolutely. Happy to take a look at that. The other one piece that I would say is that we are aware that outreach continues to be an issue. One of the things that's happened historically with state agencies is centralization of operations. Right now, I would say that, seven, eight of our finance officers are located in Salem. One of the things that we're doing is hiring now in regions around the state. That is an immediate way to improve visibility, accessibility, et cetera. That's going to take some time because we can't create new positions. We have to transition positions. But that is something that we are looking at currently. But your points are very well taken, and we will be continuing to work on those.
John, we appreciate you. You do great work for the state of Oregon. Thanks for coming and sharing thoughts with us. Okay. Heather, come on up. We've chewed up 3 minutes of your time, so we'll give it to you on the backside. But
okay,
if we could try and wrap up by about 3:35, that would be perfect.
Sure thing.
Well,
hi. So for the record, my name is Heather Stafford. I'm the Assistant Director of Innovation and Entrepreneurship at Business Oregon. I live in Portland, but I serve the whole state. It's my pleasure to talk to the committee today. Thank you so much. We have a big opportunity ahead of us as a state, and I want to share some of the work that we've been doing to address some of the issues, actually, that were brought up today. So I'm glad I'm actually going toward the end of this panel, because you've got a chance to hear about the programs that we have been using in the state to address in entrepreneurship and supporting small businesses. So the state has made substantial investments, sustained investments in these programs for decades. But what I want to talk to you about today, and based on the changes in our world, the changes in our state, I want to talk a little bit about the future. So I don't want to talk about a program. I'm not here to talk about a new program. I'm here to talk about strategy. And Governor Brown has made two things very clear, which we take to heart, and my division was founded around. The first is we're going to increase our focus on growing our own companies. So knowing that 70% or more of the jobs created in our state come from companies who already call Oregon home, we're going to focus more on that. Now, we still have retention development services, business development officers, recruitment. We have global trade. We have a bank within Business Oregon you heard from. We do have a lot of other tools, but this is a focus shift. And number two, we're going to reach out to the Oregon that we have not been serving. And we have been over-serving some in our business development resources and under-serving many. So in the governor's own words recently, she stated that the goal is to create a thriving statewide economy that encourages our businesses to hum in every single corner of the state. And to accomplish this goal, equity must be at the forefront. So we've been building, as assistant director and my team at Business Oregon, has been building this Office of Innovation and Entrepreneurship for nearly a year and a half now. Time flies. I've spent a lot of time in that amount of time going around looking at our economy, looking at our people, looking at our assets, looking at our small business programs, looking at our money, and in order to devise a statewide strategy to support innovation and entrepreneurship. So I see my job as supporting entrepreneurs. And in order to do that, you really have to listen, and you have to devise a strategy that comes from their actual needs, not what we may think they need, what do they actually need. So we've spent a lot of time, interviewed hundreds and hundreds now of entrepreneurs to see if we can find some trends and get some answers to that question. There are about 350,000 entrepreneurs in this state, which is a much larger number when I did this research than I thought we'd find. No single entity or program can pull this off. 350,000 is a lot. It's a lot of people, and that doesn't even include your solopreneurs. It doesn't include many of your would-be entrepreneurs, and it certainly doesn't include your youth who will very soon want to pursue the path toward entrepreneurship. So we need a smart strategy, and we'd like to explain what I've got cooking, what we've got cooking at the state level, and I have a few slides to show you and a very short video clip, and then we'll have time for a discussion and questions, I hope. So our charge is innovation and entrepreneurship. So we're looking at fostering innovation, more entrepreneurs, better entrepreneurs, and increased access to capital. Those are the focuses of my team. And we want an Oregon that's an entrepreneur-friendly state. I think we can all agree on that. Entrepreneurs can work from anywhere. Increasingly now in the world, they can work anywhere they like. So are we creating an environment that's friendly to innovators and entrepreneurs to want to be here? And what does that entrepreneurial culture look like? So we were tasked with looking at this, and we recognized that we need a culture shift in many parts of the state to pull this off. An infrastructure where entrepreneurs can find one another is going to be helpful. And right now, entrepreneurs are in kind of a pinball machine situation. They're kind of on their own. They're bouncing from one disconnected service provider to another. They're asking one question. They may or may not get some degree of ability to respond to their needs, but especially when you get to specialized services like intellectual property attorneys and securities attorneys, investment professionals, and you need very specialized services, those mentors and that intensive experience and mentoring just isn't in some places of this state. So how do we provide access to that without, you know, we already talked about how large the state is and Melissa Drugi's territory. Without driving 7 hours in any direction, how can we make these things available for everyone? I wanted to share some of the things we've discovered, but let's talk about what an entrepreneur is. So I want to have you just imagine for a second, entrepreneur, just see the word. Who are these people? Who are these magical creatures, the entrepreneurs? And I imagine that, like many, this is sort of what you see. This is our experience in what you see. Number one, they're probably male. Number two, they're probably young. Number three, they're probably white. And number four, they're probably doing something with computers or something very sciencey and techy. I would like us all to just have the lens going forward that entrepreneurs are people. They're problem solvers. They're critical thinkers. They're risk takers. They're not companies. They're not widgets. And they're certainly not machines. So this is a people-driven solution. And people drive innovation. So this is what entrepreneurs really look like in this state. And they're very diverse. I've been traveling the state working in rural communities, working with entrepreneurs there all over the Portland metro area. And this is who I talk to. This is who we talk to. And I'm sure the small business development centers can attest to this. This is what our ecosystem looks like. So what does it mean to support? These are the questions that we've been asking at Business Oregon. What does it mean to support this kind of innovation and entrepreneurship? Regardless of demographic, when entrepreneurs can live anywhere, how do we create an environment that is friendly to innovation and entrepreneurship as diverse as this? So I'd like to share a little bit about employment because this is important. So 98% of all Oregon firms have less than 100 employees. So if we have programs that focus on that 2%, we're not getting quite the bang for our buck that we might hope for. 89% of those companies in Oregon have less than 20 employees, and 82% have less than 9. So these kind of companies are really the lifeblood of our economy. And that 9% or that 82% represents 101,000 firms in the state of Oregon. So there are nearly 350,000 registered businesses in the state of Oregon. And to make the numbers even more significant, in the state of Oregon, there are identified 269,000 non-employers in the state of Oregon. So these are your freelancers and solopreneurs and those people. And just for perspective, Willow County, that's 45% of the workforce in Willow County. So there is a strong motivation in rural, especially, to live where you want to live and create a living, even if it's just for yourself. So some other perspective is there are about 107,000 individuals unemployed in Oregon today. Those companies under 9 employees, imagine if every single one of those hired one person, we would be at full employment. So the strategy that we're looking at is somewhat hybridized between community development and economic development, because it's communities that are going to nurture these companies and drive them forward. So my team isn't necessarily about jobs. We're more about the ecosystem and a human infrastructure, but I do want to share where the jobs are coming from. And the 95.7% of all Oregon companies employ under 50 employees, and they're responsible for 40% of the workforce. That is significant enough to deserve a very large portion of our time and effort, especially with the amount of companies that I shared with you before that are in that section. So our Imagine statement, I just would like to share, if we had a vision statement for the work that we're doing in my division, it would be this. Imagine that every entrepreneur has access to high-quality resources, tools, mentoring, and capital to launch, grow, and scale a viable business, no matter where they live or who they are. And we traditionally have looked at entrepreneurship and innovation kind of one-dimensionally. We've been looking at incubators and accelerators and angel funds, and that's a very small percentage of highly scalable, capital-efficient, traded sector businesses that they'll succeed and then trickle down to the rest of us. And I think that is sometimes true, and there is quite a robust ecosystem designed to support those types of companies, but as we saw, they're a very small percentage of the number of companies we see in our state. So our work is to provide a much more multidimensional approach and looking at all types of entrepreneurs. And in that vision statement, we identified a few things that are standing in the way of that goal, to have a One Oregon that's accessible to all kinds of entrepreneurs. And one is inefficient networks. So we noticed that we have a very fragmented and inefficient technical resource system. There's multiple interconnected or unconnected agencies, networks, organizations that overlap. Sometimes they compete. Sometimes they're not available in certain parts of the state. Services are invisible. And I say this is the biggest one. This is from the entrepreneur's mouth, not ours. Services are very hard to find. They're often invisible. They don't know where the capital is. They don't know where the services are. They don't know where the mentors are. Sometimes they're in isolated offices all over, dispersed around a city, or not there at all. Especially in rural and many of our communities, the resources are just insufficient. And you'll hear in the little video clip how insufficient they are for some. And then number four is they're unequally accessible. They overserve some, underserve most. We want an environment where, you know, our tribes, bilingual entrepreneurs, communities of color, women, youth entrepreneurs have an opportunity to find and pursue their dreams to own a small business. So
really quick, go back to that slide. If you could, please. I'm good with the bottom three, but I'm struggling with the top one up above. When you say unconnected, are you saying that providers don't know who each other are?
I think locally they certainly do, and there's some handoff that happens. But at a statewide level, that network needs further connection. We need to connect the resources that are not just in Portland, but rural to rural, and provide that connective tissue. It's really, you know, what Representative Esquivel said. It's, you know, you can't sell something that you don't. Correct me again?
I get that on the invisible services. If you can't find it, how do you do it? I'm trying to figure out if I mean, I'm under the assumption, and if I'm wrong, I need to be corrected, but for the most part in our communities, the providers know who the other providers are. There might be some overlap, and sometimes they compete. I mean, heck, DEQ competes with Business Oregon on loan programs for wastewater systems. But I'm just trying to get my arms around. You're not saying, though, that the providers don't know who each other are locally.
Locally, no, but we do have 60 incubators and accelerators in the state of Oregon, plus a whole host of co-working spaces and other types of people who are doing a lot of great work in service of entrepreneurs that the state doesn't necessarily fund, which is good, I think, because we do need to connect those passionate people that are providing this stuff. So there, it is a very inefficient system and a network. And I think 10 years ago, I think what you'll hear, the ideas and the strategy we're proposing, you couldn't have done 10 years ago because the technology wasn't there. It's gotten very less expensive. It works better. And I think that there are things we can do to make these accessible.
Sure. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. This is extremely interesting and exciting information, so thanks for your great work. I'm intrigued by what you said about us increasing the sort of organization of all the systems so they work together. Is there a roadmap, sort of a visual or computer roadmap anywhere that documents the great work of everyone who's testified before us today and kind of what the various roles are?
Yes, co-chairs and Representative Leininger, it's in the works. It's not exactly done. And because we manage in my team a sort of broad spectrum of tools on innovation with Oregon Innovation Council, and then this is our attempt to bring cohesion to the entrepreneurship ecosystem, then we also have the Oregon Growth Board, which is on the capital and angel and venture side. How can we line those up? We do the capital scan. So how can we line up the capital scan resources and gaps along with these? So we will produce something for you very soon along those lines.
So I just wanted to be clear that what I'm hearing you say, this is great to hear, is that that is precisely the kind of work that you are doing in your innovative group over the last year. So that's great.
I hope we're being innovative, yes.
Seems like you are.
Thank you.
Chair Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you for this information. I hate to even bring this up, Mr. Co-Chair, but I look at one more barrier that's not on the list, and we've heard this over and over again from businesses that have come before us and businesses we've talked to, and that is the lack of qualified, motivated, job-ready employees and this disheartening disconnect that we've got between the people that are looking for work, the 100,000 that you referenced earlier, and the businesses that have help wanted signs in their window all across the state. Yeah. I continue to struggle with that.
Great point. Great point.
Co-Chair Gomberg, I struggle with that as well, and we're not the workforce development department, unfortunately, or we would do more tangible things around that. But I do think that creating an environment that there's a culture where innovators and entrepreneurs get together, there's a vibrant community there that will attract the types of workers that are currently not seeing, especially rural communities, as an option for a place to live. So culture is ultimately important. And, you know, we could talk about millennials and things like that. But, you know, how can you replicate those the type of environment where they like to live in a place that isn't urban Portland? Because, frankly, they can't afford to live there anymore. So opportunity abounds for other parts of the state. So, like I said, we've been looking at this from an entrepreneur's perspective, and I think it may be tempting to devise strategies based on what we know and the programs that we already have. And there are a lot of resources, and there is a great infrastructure, but we really need to listen to our entrepreneurs. And overwhelmingly, what we heard from them was kind of summed up in this quote from an entrepreneur in Baker City, and she said, "It's all well and good to have programs and local advisors, but if I can't find them, they're not helpful to me." So entrepreneurs really are struggling with knowing what resources are available to them, and as you'll hear in a little quote from an entrepreneur in the video, business moves quickly, and they need to move at that pace to be successful. So this program, or this initiative that we've been cooking up in my group is called READY, although we're going to change that acronym. It was really just about this pilot initiative that we've been working on. We did this with the $250,000 SRF to search for new Strategic Reserve Fund investment. And we were looking for new models and some creativity and looking for partnerships that were existing in rural to set up new models for innovation and entrepreneurship ecosystems. So we're we're not starting a new program. There are plenty of programs in the state. We just need to better connect them. So we are here to bring the state under a strategy to grow innovation and entrepreneurship, which is what my office was created to do. Our focus is three things. So the first is using underutilized community assets, resources, people, programs, places. And two, connecting local resources more effectively that support small businesses, making them more visible. And three, connecting statewide resources so that they are available locally. And we must now really build the capacity where entrepreneurs can find each other as well. That's a big opportunity that we sometimes forget how creative and how much mentoring happens from entrepreneur to entrepreneur if they're able to find each other. This is why co-working spaces and incubators have had some success. I don't think it's always because of the genius mentors in the room. Sometimes they figure it out by being around each other. So I will just actually move on to what we're doing. We piloted this. We heard from 24 different collaborative applications with this in communities all over rural Oregon. And we identified four communities who we felt were ready, pardon the acronym, but we're ready to bring on this capacity because they had some sort of asset. They had a great collaboration together. They had and they were standing up collaboratively with their hands up to say, yes, we want to do this. We are working with two programs as well, which we're boxing up. So Adelante Mujeres does a fully delivered program in Spanish, and we're working with them to box up their program, so to speak, and see if we can deliver it to other communities around the state, delivered totally in Spanish. And then we're working with Hatch Innovation, who's doing things around community capital, most of our rural communities really lack access to capital, so that's a program that wants to be pulled down. This is a network that will be, we hope, if we build it out, accessible to all the service providers in the state. And we don't see each of the centers as just recipients of services, recipients of information. We also, in our experience so far, have seen that they have a lot to offer. There's expertise that lives locally that could be shared with other communities. So this is a two-way street. You may think that this would be the approach that we would take. I think often people do when you try and get services piped in from elsewhere that we would do it this way. And in our experience and having worked in economic development, innovation, entrepreneurship for a few years in Southern Oregon, as well as other rural parts of the country, this isn't the answer. We've tried this. In fact, I've actually tried and failed at this a couple of times. So this really isn't the answer. What we are talking about here is a virtual connected statewide network, and we're working to cultivate a truly functional startup ecosystem that includes access by the entire state and all varieties of entrepreneurs. Now, you probably get tired of hearing from me, I imagine. I sort of get tired of being the champion of this. And so I'd really like to just let you hear this from the voices of the folks that
we're
here to serve.
So we have to go really quick because I've got you for 90 more seconds.
90 more seconds. Well, if any time you want to cut this off.
Could she just email it to
No, her? Any business resources here in town.
Could you email
business,
that to us?
Absolutely.
Related things other than financial and,
yeah, right.
You know,
I
that is
sure
perfect.
If the committee has any questions, they can ask questions. And then I do have to keep this on schedule here.
Sure thing. I'm happy to also provide more resources about the program and any other questions you have offline as well. So.
Perfect. Questions? Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I like what Ms. Stafford is doing, and I particularly like her goal of getting solopreneurs in Oregon to hire somebody. But the Human Resources Department in my micro company would make me sleep on the couch tonight if I didn't at least put on the record that hiring one employee is remarkably inefficient. You go from being a designer and maker of widgets to being somebody who has to know about unemployment taxes, human resources regulation, retirement savings accounts, and a variety of other things that we at the legislature have imposed on them. And I think as this committee goes forward, we've got to figure out a way to make it easier for small mom-and-pop operations that don't have a human resources, an accountant, and an attorney on staff to hire these folks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a great
agreed
point.
Yeah. Co-Chair Gomberg, I can't disagree with that. Just took a note.
Any other questions? Do you have any concluding thoughts on that?
No, it's exciting. I think I really love the work that I and my team have an opportunity to do with the state. And I think in times of plenty, which we are in, we were the best performing economy in the country last year, and there's a whole lot of other indicators that show that we're doing well. I know our internal budgetary environment isn't ideal, but I think when you have opportunities to invest, especially in infrastructure, in human infrastructure, in rural, you'll weather more macro storms when they come.
Thank
you so much. I just want to note, and I know it's not in the scope of our conversation today, that in one arena, I know that Business Oregon has been doing tremendous teamwork and connective tissue building with a huge swath of people, urban and rural, and that's in the food and beverage sector and that value-added processing. And at some point, when the time is right, I just want to express that I'm very excited to hear the recommendations that broad team of people has come up with, because I think, that's such an opportunity to create rural job opportunities and also opportunities all throughout the state and in a traded sector context eventually. So looking forward to hearing about that.
Great. Representative Langener, I'll get that message to the folks that put that together and have them appear before you next time. It's really interesting.
I defer to my co-chairs on how to work it, but it's exciting from what I understand about it.
So talk to us about in those communities just very briefly. What if you get a major partner who doesn't want to partner?
It's happened already, even in the communities that we're working in. And, there are things that we're just up against. I mean, we're a very large, very rural state. Two-thirds of our population live in one northwest corner of the state. And to say that Northeast Oregon is one place is not accurate. I mean, you're 2.5-3 hours from any direction. We want to better connect these sort of micro communities. That's why we're trying to, which communities are ready? Which ones are standing up? Which ones want to do this? Which ones have a collaboration together? In Coos Bay, for example, which is where some of the videos that you'll see when I send them over to you are, they've got 11 partners ready to move in and co-locate together, mm-hmm. including both tribes and OSU's extension. And they kind of know what they want to be, and they want to open up a second floor for a co-working innovation an entrepreneurship hub, and it's right downtown. Now, of course, that's going to cost money. Of course, there's urban renewal, but you'll see from the city manager and from their small business development center director and from an entrepreneur kind of the opportunity as they see it. And we're really, these are grassroots, ground-up community development solutions. We're not designing this from on high and dictating how everyone should do this, which is why the process can be a little messy. And so we're just going with those that stand up and say that they're ready to do this and they know what they want to do.
Last question. Would you envision the governor's community solutions teams moving in on these collaborations and being in the centrally located with everyone as well?
Well, it'd certainly be ideal. And they are talking about doing so in Coos Bay at that collaborative. The idea of a one-stop center but for business is their vision for what they're doing down there. But you can't force this stuff, right? I mean, there are local relationships, there's local politics, there's local budgets, and we'll just have to, show by example, hopefully. Show a few successes and create a model out of this, which is what we're really after.
And again, with any type of program, there's questions. The final question I want to ask is, how do you maintain confidentiality? Someone comes into a local hub in Coos Bay and they're going through a divorce and they're liquidating their business. And by the way, DEQ sent them a notice for a wastewater thing in their backyard of the company. How do you manage all that?
I think the vision for the capacity out in rural is more to be one of those traffic cops and to have a directory of resources, not to be a new program. So if local providers and programs want to be there and they find value in it, maybe a small business development center does their counseling one-on-one in the community center where it's confidential, and then they come and do some classes and some programming that's much more open to the public in one of these more local centers. It could work like that.
Interesting. Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah,
really
thank you all.
Appreciate it. All right. Craig, come on down. Who do we have? Reynold, Sarah, come on down. So our goal is to be out by 4 o'clock. Uh, 15 minutes? 17 minutes.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair Smith, Co-Chair Gomberg, we will do our best to get you out of here on time. For the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of the Coalition for Capital, which is a group of large nationwide companies that invest through new markets, tax credits, and other apparatuses to invest in small businesses throughout the country. In particular, I'm going to be talking to you today about the Oregon Low-Income Community Jobs Initiative. Wanted to start with two quick thank yous. One is thank you to this committee for your work in trying to find solutions that help small business in the state. Also wanted to take the opportunity to thank the folks at Business Oregon, in particular John Saris, Nick Batts, and Laura Engstrom for the work that they've done around the new markets tax credit here in Oregon. To give you kind of the brief 30,000 foot, and it's not terribly accurate, but it comes close. Investment grows business. Business growth creates jobs. Jobs increase the need for goods and services, and that demand in turn grows the economy. And a growing economy promotes business growth. What we're talking about today is the piece that inserts the investment, the money, the capital that's necessary for those businesses to grow. The Oregon Low Income Community Jobs Initiative began with the policy proposition that it's an appropriate role of government to invest its resources to help grow the economy, and in particular those parts of the states that are economically disadvantaged. It should not do so without the ability for it to recoup those investments. And Sarah will talk more about the state's return on investment to the general fund and the bang for the buck, if you will. But the bottom line is that the program works, and it does it by four different things. First, it attracts out-of-state investors. It leverages their dollars through the tax credit. It makes capital available to small businesses that otherwise would not have access to that capital in whole or part. And then it, through the policies that surround the code that we put in place, it focuses those investments, and in that it can be very flexible, and we'll be talking to you a bit more about that near the end. When you're making funding flexible, as you've learned, sometimes it's about a business that has demand and they need to grow because they just don't have the space, they don't have the infrastructure, the machinery that they need to move forward. Some of them need to invest because if they don't invest, they'll go out of business because they can no longer compete in their current structure. The New Markets Tax Credit allows those sorts of things to happen. The proposal that we're going to be making for you today, the Oregon New Markets Tax Credit, and by the way, we'll use those terms interchangeably, the Low-Income Community Jobs Initiative is Oregon's version of the New Markets Tax Credit. We have done this once before. It started in 2011, and there the state of Oregon decided to invest $87 million of its money. I just screwed that around. $78 million of its general fund to make sure that we were allowing for $200 million of investment in small businesses in Oregon. What we're coming forward to you today is to ask for a new allocation that would make $300 million available over the next 7 years in the amount that would, to the general fund, cost about $117 million over the scope of those 7 years. Something that's important to realize is that unlike other tax credits, the New Markets Tax Credit doesn't have a sunset clause. Essentially what happens is the state allocates money, and once that money is invested, that's it. There isn't any more money that comes. It doesn't continue, except to the extent that that money is out there invested until the 7 years are up. That money is then done. And so essentially what we're asking for is for a new set of money to be put in to allow new business demand to take advantage of the program that they can't currently do now because we're fully allocated. The tax credit is unique in that those who are taking advantage of the tax credit don't get to take advantage of it until the third year of their investment, which means their money has to be on the ground in the business for a full 2 years before they're able to take advantage of their investment through the tax credit, which occurs in the last 5 years. To make it as basic as we can get it, in the third year you get a 7% tax credit, and then you get an 8% tax credit in years 4 through 7. The investors are not allowed to take any of the, I already mentioned that. One of the things that we've noticed, and the reason why we aren't back here asking for $200 million, we're asking for $300 million, is because as the people to my left and right, who I should probably introduce, have noticed through their business, is that they have more demand now, and they accounted for about half of the projects in the last set of allocations. their demand now is greater than the total of the first round of new markets allocations. And with that kind of demand, it made sense for us to go forward and be a little bit bold because we know that the program does create jobs. The people who are to my left and right, and it's always a pleasure as a lobbyist who doesn't have great deal of expertise, is when you have people who do have expertise to your left and right. So if you screw up, they can take care of all the problems and they can explain things better than I can. We have Reynold Rader and Sarah Pietka, who are both with the Reynold Rader and Associates LLC, who do this for a living. They're going to try to avoid a lot of the terms that come along with this program. It is a federal program. One of the nice things about a federal program is that a lot of the administrative costs that we as a state would otherwise have to bear, that's being taken care of by the federal government. The downside is you get to deal with terms like CDEs, QEIs, QLICEs, QualifBs. We're going to try to avoid all that stuff that the federal government gives us, but you
Bless
don't
you.
Need to worry about. And so they're going to talk knowledgeably about the background on the new markets tax credit at the federal level, the state tax credit, and some of the things that we've done with it and what the return on investment is. And with that, I think I'm going to turn it over to Reynold.
Thanks, Craig.
Welcome.
Thanks. First of all, I want to start, just give you a little bit of background about Ray.
Introduce yourself.
Oh, just give us your name for the record, and you're set.
We're doing this.
You're doing perfect.
So I'm Reynold Rader. I'm the CEO and founder of Rader & Company, LLC. And to my right is Sarah Pietka, who is also my daughter. We are a family-owned business. We're one of 350,000, I discovered from the earlier conversation, of the small right. businesses in Oregon. We've kind of found our niche in this new market tax credit arena. We did some of the early work in the early days of the program back in 2000, 2002. Was involved in Portland Family Funds, United Fund Advisors, and that was an entity that was sort of started up by the Portland Development Commission. So we kind of owe some of our background to government and the hand that it had in guiding us. I want to talk about the federal program, and I want to start there because that, as Craig was saying, is how the Oregon program is based on. What we tried to do is leverage off as much of that as we could in developing the Oregon program. We actually were involved in placing about half of the $200 million from the original program, so we saw a lot of the deals that were done in the state up close and personal. The federal program, as you mentioned, is also a 39% tax credit. You can think of it as if it were an investment tax credit. Unlike the Oregon tax credit, it's front-loaded. It's 5% in the first 3 years and then 6% in the back 4 years. So on a net present value basis, that's more valuable than the state credit. You just need to understand that because if you ever get into a discussion about economics, it's that present value calculation that makes the Oregon tax credit less than the federal tax credit. Like I said, it was started in 2000. The driver here is that we were trying to drive investment into what's called low-income communities. So they do that by defining those to be those where the poverty rate is at least 20% and the median income does not exceed 80% of the area median income. That actually works out to be about 40% of all census tracts in the nation. So it roughly that translates the same into the state of Oregon. Since its inception, there's been $43.5 billion of new market tax credit investment in the nation. It's highly successful. There's currently around a $7 billion that is about to be announced, we speculate, in November. That money will become available for investment in Oregon as much as we can get competitively. So there's the Oregon program actually acts as a magnet for federal allocation. So if we were to make another $300 million available, it would attract additional federal allocation. It's administered at the federal level by the Community Development Financial Institutions Fund. That's a division of the U.S. Treasury. In order to qualify under the Oregon program, you have to be certified as a community development entity under the national program to be eligible under the Oregon program. There's under the federal program, they estimate that there's been 197,000, almost 200,000 jobs created in the nation since inception. That's helped construct 32.4 million of manufacturing space, 74.8 million square feet of office space, and 57.5 million square feet of retail space. Again, highly successful at that level. Oregon has a couple things that differentiate it from the federal program. So that there's a cap on the Oregon program that no more than $8 million of allocation can go into a specific project. So that works on limiting the amount of exposure you have to any one credit. You can think of it that way. There's a requirement that it be owner-occupied real estate. You can't do like a downtown office building and lease out all the property to, say, 100 different tenants. There's a 15% the total available allocation carved out for reducing greenhouse gas projects.
Not reducing the projects, of course.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And we've done some of those. We did a wind power plant, for instance. That's kind of the background you need, I think, then to understand what happened with the $200 million that the state had. And so Sarah's going to take you through those numbers.
Okay. I'm Sarah Pieka, Vice President, Reader & Company, LLC. And all the numbers that are included in the packet that we've distributed to you were pulled directly from the transparency website that Business Oregon maintains. So the CDEs, the entities that are responsible for applying for and then deploying these investments, are also required to report annually to Business Oregon, who administers the state-level program, on the results. And so we have results through June 30th of 2015, reflecting $178 million of investments. Since then, the remaining balance has been deployed, so all $200 million is out. So of the initial allocation that was been deployed, that was deployed into 34 projects. It created 1,177 permanent full-time jobs paying an average wage of $15.71 per hour. The investments also helped companies retain jobs. So when you add in the retained jobs, you're over 2,500 jobs created with the $178 million of allocation, which is slightly less than $70 million of tax expenditures. Alongside this $178 million of state allocation, $137 million of federal allocation was also paired with that investment. So that's a 76.5% match rate in terms of when we used state allocation and having that matched with federal.
Is the state allocation required to obtain the federal?
No. Okay. What is required is the CDEs who apply for allocation under the state program have to have one federal allocation in the past. So in terms of relieving administrative burden, you know that community development entity has been applied and been awarded allocation at the federal level, and the U.S. Treasury has reviewed everything to ensure that entity qualifies.
Okay.
So it helps with underwriting, but it's not written into the current rules that you have to have both. Okay.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. Sorry about that.
Nope, no problem. One of the highlights of the state program to date is that over 41% of the projects were located in rural Oregon. On the national program, only 17.8% of the investment has occurred in the rural territory in the whole country. So the Oregon state program has dramatically outperformed the federal on that standpoint, and I think there's a map in your materials that shows some highlights of how well dispersed the investments have been. We also have diversity not just geographically but also by sector. So this program is one of the more flexible programs in terms of funding. There's not much in terms of limitations and size of investment, type of investment, type of business, and so out of the 34 projects, 12 went to manufacturing businesses, so that was the leading sector. We also had healthcare, education, renewable energy, obviously, community facilities, and retail businesses as well. And we also had at least two startup businesses that I know also received funding through the Oregon NMTC program. We used the data from the transparency website to pull together a break-even analysis to figure out how we are achieving our bang for our buck. Using the actual wage and actual jobs created, we break even in year 10 using only payroll taxes from those jobs created. So that assumes no further job hiring, which As Brendel and I are familiar with a lot of the jobs that have been closed to date, most of them are outperforming their hiring targets from when we closed the transactions. So this assumes no further hiring, no wage raises, no corporate income tax, no licensing fees or any other ancillary revenues at all. We're not considering any property tax increases from increasing the size of the property base because of real estate investments. So excluding all of that, it takes 10 years to break even, just assuming the 2,500 jobs created and the actual average wage. If you include indirect jobs as well, then you are breaking even the entire time. You're above break even the whole time. It's also important to note that this analysis doesn't include any sort of time value of money reset. So you're getting the benefit of those jobs and the payroll taxes immediately, and you're not seeing any tax expenditures associated with the creation of those jobs until year three. So any sort of time value of money calculation is not included in our break-even analysis either. So we wanted to be as conservative as possible to demonstrate that this program really is effective and really is a great tool and way to use tax dollars to actually generate additional business. Any questions on the numbers?
No.
Okay.
That was helpful.
So we're here with a plan. Somebody, I forget who has said that, you know, somebody needs to come back with a plan. So this is our plan for the Small Business Growth Committee, is to re-implement or create more or additional allocation so the program can continue. We're not asking for a lot of rule changes. We're just asking for let's just do it again. Mm-hmm. Let's make it larger because, as Craig stated, we've applied as a CDE for $25 million in this current allocation. I said $7 billion was outstanding. We as an entity have applied for $25 million of that. And we want to be – and in our pipeline, when we submitted our federal application, we had $252 million projects just in the state of Oregon. Since then, we've added to that list. So there is a ton of demand for this. At the federal level, there's a ton of demand as well. It's probably, I think it's like 6-1. Of the $7 billion they'll award, that means there's probably $42 billion applications or pipelines of projects. And these aren't, you know, there are some very real, there are a lot of very real projects in there. We have projects that deal with this workforce training that we were talking about. We have two community colleges that want to expand their campuses, right? And it's all about job training at those community colleges. We have a project at the Port of Morrill that has said that they would team with the local community college out there in training their workforce. We have addressed it with some of the deals that we've closed already. You'll see we provided as some of the materials we submitted. This is just a package of the types of projects that we've closed that are included in the numbers that Sarah summarized earlier. But in there is there's the St. Vincent de Paul project where there's some job training going on there. There's some Portland's Hacienda Mercado in the Lentz area, the training that goes on there. So there's lots of job training pieces to it. One of our projects in our pipeline was the expansion of the CTEC facility that you guys were talking about earlier in Salem, and branching that out to cover different vocations and training there. So we think this is part of the plan at dealing with that job training stuff. It is for facilities. I mean, a lot of these things are projects that get built in their actual facilities. There was a fried food project in Representative Ben's district that, was 300 and some odd jobs that were created. They reopened an onion processing plant that had been closed for a period of time. Getting that open was huge for that community. Those weren't the highest wages, but that's 300 jobs in a community where those 300 jobs are really appreciated. And that's in rural Oregon. We have We create, I know you guys met with the bioscience cluster, and one of the things they told you is, hey, we don't have enough lab space. You know, this tax credit can be used to build out those sorts of facilities. We've actually had some conversations with people in that field. They're part of our pipeline now. They weren't in there when we applied, but they're in there now, and the types of projects that they're trying to build.
Yeah, I think there's definitely been a great use of these resources, and I think Oregon's benefited from this. I'm going to ask you to take 60 seconds. I pride myself on wrapping up on time, and so we could just conclude here really quickly. We can always have you come back if Chair Gomberg would be open to that.
Representative Smith, Co-Chair Smith, Co-Chair Gomberg, essentially what we're asking for is this committee to consider the idea of putting forward a proposal to expand the New Markets Tax Credit. It's extremely flexible, and we will work with the committee administrator, if you choose to go down that path, to make best use of that flexibility to reflect the needs that you've heard from small businesses in your meetings to this point.
How is that done in the past? When this legislation was originally introduced, did it start in a policy committee and then move through to Ways and Means, or did it originate in Ways and Means? Do you recall?
Co-Chair Smith, it actually originated in, I want to say, the Economic Development Committee.
Okay.
And then moved from there. Generally, it has to end up going through the revenue committees, although at that point in time, we also had a special joint committee on tax credits. So that was the way that one ended up being dealt with.
Got it. Okay.
But we stand ready to assist you in whatever way is necessary if you choose to go forward, and we would strongly encourage you to do so because this answers a large chunk of the capital need that you've
heard
about.
You know, the one thing I would counsel on this is for a lot of members who are new to the body is maybe to have a worksheet at about the eighth grade level that helps follow the money and how this all plays through. My background's finance, and it was complicated to me at first, but once you understand how it works, that's a great program for Oregon. It really is. So, any other questions or comments from the committee? All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate this. Colleagues, we're 1 or 2 minutes past the hour. No, I'm sorry.
You blew it.
What do we need to know?
Next meeting is Legislative Days, Thursday the 22nd, noon to 1:30.
Chair Gomberg, you're going to lead us through that meeting.
I will indeed, Mr. Co-Chair. Jan will be back with us. We appreciate Patrick standing in now. Colleagues, I think there are some paperwork in your files there that you might want to turn in before we adjourn.
Right.
And Mr. Co-Chair, I'll also mention, I think the committee and observers will note that while we spent the last couple of months listening to business sectors, that today we've spent some time listening to folks that council support and assist small businesses and getting some additional information from them. But we are working to synthesize those nuggets that we talked about 6 months ago and identify potential legislation that we can use with the information that we've garnered here. And we're going to continue to work on that. I expect we'll be reporting back on that at the next meeting or the meeting after.
Very well said.
Good.
Very well said. Any other comments from the committee? Sure appreciate you. Sure appreciate everyone who endured the last 3 hours, and we're going to adjourn. 3 hours, and we're going to adjourn. Endured the last